in a rush, causing Navani to scramble off her seat and back away. The light swirled in the chamber and became another larger map, floating at about table height, in the center of the room. Mountains grew up like furrows in a piece of cloth pressed together. Vast plains shone green from vines and fields of grass. Barren, stormward hillsides grew splendid shadows of life on the leeward sides. Storm, Father. As she watched, the topography of the landscape became real. Shallan's breath caught. Had she done that? How? Her illusions usually required a previous drawing to imitate. The map stretched to the sides of the room, shimmering at the edges. Adolin stood up from his seat, crashing through the middle of the illusion somewhere near Carbranth. Wisps of stormlight broke around him, but when he moved, the image swirled and neatly reformed behind him. How? Dalinar leaned down near their section, which detailed the Reshi Isles. The detail is amazing. I can almost see the cities. What did you do?
I don't know if I did anything, Shallan said, stepping into the illusion, feeling the stormlight swirl around her. Despite the detail, the perspective was still from very far away, and the mountains weren't even as tall as one of her fingernails. I couldn't have created this, Bright Lord. I don't have the knowledge.
Well, I didn't do it, Renarin said. The stormlight quite certainly came from you, Brightness.
Yes, well, your father was tugging on me at the time.
Tugging? Adolin asked. The Storm Father, Dalinar said. This is his influence. This is what he sees each time a storm blows across Roshar. It wasn't me or you, but us, somehow.
Well, Shallan noted, you were complaining about not being able to take it all in.
How much stormlight did this take? Navani asked, rounding the outside of the new, vibrant map.
Shallan checked her satchel. All of it?
We'll get you more, Navani said with a sigh.
I'm sorry for—
No, Dalinar said. Having my radiance practice with their powers is among the most valuable resources I could purchase right now. Even if Hatham makes us pay through the nose for spheres.
Dalinar strode through the image, disrupting it in a swirl around him. He stopped near the center, beside the location of Urethiru. He looked from one side of the room to the other in a long, slow survey.
10 cities,
he whispered.
10 kingdoms. 10 oath gates connecting them from long ago. This is how we fight it. This is how we begin. We don't start by saving the world. We start with this simple step. We protect the cities with oath gates. The Voidbringers are everywhere, but we can be more mobile. We can shore up capitals, deliver food or soulcasters quickly between kingdoms. We can make those 10 cities bastions of light and strength. But we must be quick. He's coming. The man with 9 shadows.
What's this? Shallan said, perking up.
The enemy's champion, Dalinar said, eyes narrowing. In the visions, Honor told me our best chance of survival involved forcing Odium to accept a contest of champions. I've seen the enemy's champion, a creature in black armor with red eyes, a parshman, perhaps. It had 9 shadows.
Nearby, Renarin had turned toward his father, eyes wide, jaw dropping. Nobody else seemed to notice.
Azimir, capital of Azir, Dalinar said, stepping from Urethiru to the center of Azir to the west, is home to an oath gate. We need to open it and gain the trust of the Azish. They will be important to our cause.
He stepped farther to the west.
There's an oath gate hidden in Shinovar, another in the capital of Babatharnam, and a fourth in far-off
Ral Elorim, City of Shadows.
Another Enrira, Navani said, joining him.
Yasna thought it was in Kurth.
A sixth was lost in Aemia, the island that was destroyed.
Dalinar grunted, then turned toward the map's eastern section.
Vaidenar makes seven, he said, stepping into Shallan's homeland. Thalen's city is eight. Then the Shattered Plains, which we hold.
And the last one is in Kolinar, Adolin said softly. Our home.
Shallan approached and touched him on the arm. Spanreed communication into the city had stopped working. Nobody knew the status of Kolinar. Their best clue had come via Kaladin's Spanreed message.
We start small, Dalinar said, with a few of the most important to holding the world. Azir, Yakaved, Thelena. We'll contact other nations, but our focus is on these three powerhouses. Azir for its organization and political clout, Thelena for its shipping and naval prowess, Yakaved for its manpower. Brightness Tavar, any insight you could offer into your homeland and its status following the civil war would be appreciated.
And Kolinar? Adolin asked.
A knock at the door interrupted Dalinar's response. He called admittance, and the scout from before peeked in.
Bright Lord, she said, looking concerned. There's something you need to see.
What is it, Lynn?
Bright Lord, sir, there's been another murder.
9. The Threads of a Screw.
The sum of my experiences has pointed at this moment, this decision.
From Oathbringer, Preface. One benefit of having become Brightness Radiant was that, for once, Shallan was expected to be a part of important events. Nobody questioned her presence during the rush through the corridors lit by oil lanterns carried by guards. Nobody thought she was out of place. Nobody even considered the propriety of leading a young woman to the scene of a brutal murder. What a welcome change! From what she overheard the scout telling Dalinar, the corpse had been a light-eyed officer named Vedekar Peril. He was from Sabariel's army, but Shallan didn't know him. The body had been discovered by a scouting party in a remote part of the tower's second level. As they drew nearer, Dalinar and his guards jogged the rest of the distance, outpacing Shallan, storming a lethe long legs. She tried to suck in some stormlight, but she'd used it all on that blasted map, which had disintegrated into a puff of light as they'd left. That left her exhausted and annoyed. Ahead of her, Adolin stopped and looked back. He danced a moment as if impatient, then hurried to her instead of running ahead.
Thanks, Shallan said as he fell into step beside her.
It's not like he can get more dead, eh? He said, then chuckled awkwardly.
Something about this had him seriously disturbed. He reached for her hand with his hurt one, which was still splinted, then winced. She took his arm instead, and he held up his oil lantern as they hurried on. The strata here spiraled, twisting around the floor, ceiling, and walls like the threads of a screw. It was striking enough that Shallan took a memory of it for later sketching. Shallan and Adolin finally caught up to the others, passing a group of guards maintaining a perimeter. Though Bridge 4 had discovered the body, they'd sent for Kolin reinforcements to secure the area. They protected a medium-sized chamber, now lit by a multitude of oil lamps. Shallan paused in the doorway right before a ledge that surrounded a wide, square depression, perhaps 4 feet deep, cut into the stone floor of the room. The wall strata here continued their curving, twisting medley of oranges, reds, and browns, ballooning out across the sides of this chamber in wide bands, before coiling back into narrow stripes to continue down the hall that led out the other side. The dead man lay at the bottom of the cavity. Shallan steeled herself, but even so found the sight nauseating. He lay on his back and had been stabbed right through the eye. His face was a bloody mess, his clothing disheveled from what looked to have been an extended fight. Dalinar and Navani stood on the ledge above the pit. His face was stiff, a stone. She stood with her safe hand raised to her lips.
"We found him just like this, Bright Lord," said Pete, the bridge man. "We sent for you immediately. Storm me if it doesn't look exactly the same as what happened to High Prince Sadeus."
"He's even lying in the same position," Navani said, grabbing her skirts and descending a set of steps into the lower area. It made up almost the entire room. In fact, Shallan looked toward the upper reaches of the chamber, where several stone sculptures, like the heads of horses, extended from the walls with their mouths open. Spouts, she thought. This was a bathing chamber. Navani knelt beside the body, away from the blood running toward a drain on the far side of the basin.
"Remarkable. The positioning. The puncturing of the eye. It's exactly like what happened to Sadeus. This has to be the same killer."
Nobody tried to shelter Navani from the sight, as if it were completely proper for the king's mother to be poking at a corpse. Who knew? Maybe in Alethkar, ladies were expected to do this sort of thing. It was still odd to Shallan how temerarious the Alethi were about towing their women into battle to act as scribes, runners, and scouts. She looked to Adolin to get his read on the situation, and found him staring, aghast, mouth open and eyes wide.
"Adolin?" Shallan asked. "Did you know him?"
He didn't seem to hear her.
"This is impossible," he muttered. "Impossible."
"Adolin?"
I didn't know him, Shallan. But I'd assumed... I figured the death of Sadeus was an isolated crime. You know how he was. Probably got himself into trouble. Any number of people could have wanted him dead, right?"
"Looks like it was something more than that," Shallan said, folding her arms as Dalinar walked down the steps to join Navani, trailed by Pete, Lopan, and, remarkably, Relaine of Bridge 4.
That one drew attention from the other soldiers, several of whom positioned themselves subtly to protect Dalinar from the Parshendi. They considered him a danger, regardless of which uniform he wore.
"Kolot," Dalinar said, looking toward the light-eyed captain who led the soldiers here. "You're an archer, aren't you? 5th Battalion?"
"Yes, sir."
"We have you scouting the tower with Bridge 4? Dalinar asked. "The Windrunners needed extra feet, sir, and access to more scouts and scribes for maps. My archers are mobile. Figured it was better than doing parade drills in the cold, so I volunteered my company."
Dalinar grunted. 5th Battalion. Who was your policing force?"
8th Company," Kolot said. "Captain Talan. Good friend of mine. He didn't make it, sir."
"I'm sorry, Captain," Dalinar said. "Would you and your men withdraw for a moment so I can consult with my son? Maintain that perimeter until I tell you otherwise, but do inform King Elokar of this and send a message to Sabariel. I'll visit and tell him about this in person, but he'd best get a warning."
"Yes, sir," the lanky archer said, calling orders. The soldiers left, including the bridgemen.
As they moved, Shallan felt something prickle at the back of her neck. She shivered and couldn't help glancing over her shoulder, hating how this unfathomable building made her feel. Renarin was standing right behind her. She jumped, letting out a pathetic squeak. Then she blushed furiously. She'd forgotten he was even with them. A few shamespren faded into view around her, floating white and red flower petals. She'd rarely attracted those, which was a wonder. She'd have thought they would take up permanent residence nearby.
"Sorry," Renarin mumbled. "Didn't mean to sneak up on you."
Adolin walked down into the room's basin, still looking distracted. Was he that upset by finding a murderer among them? People tried to kill him practically every day. Shallan grabbed the skirt of her hava and followed him down, staying clear of the blood.
"This is troubling," Dalinar said. "We face a terrible threat that would wipe our kind from Roshar like leaves before the storm wall. I don't have time to worry about a murderer slinking through these tunnels."
He looked up at Adolin.
"Most of the men I'd have assigned to an investigation like this are dead. Niter, Malan, the King's Guard is no better. And the Bridgemen, for all their fine qualities, have no experience with this sort of thing. I'll need to leave it to you, son."
"Me?" Adolin said.
"You did well investigating the incident with the King's saddle, even if that turned out to be something of a wind chase. Aladar is High Prince of Information. Go to him, explain what happened, and set one of his policing teams to investigate. Then work with them as my liaison."
"You want me," Adolin said,
"to investigate who killed Sadius?"
Dalinar nodded, squatting down beside the corpse, though Shallan had no idea what he expected to see. The fellow was very dead.
"Perhaps if I put my son on the job, it will convince people I'm serious about finding the killer. Perhaps not. They might just think I've put someone in charge who can keep the secret. Storms. I miss Yasna. She would have known how to spin this, to keep opinion from turning against us in court. Either way, son, stay on this. Make sure the remaining High Princes at least know that we consider these murders a priority, and that we are dedicated to finding the one who committed them."
Adolin swallowed.
"I understand."
Shallan narrowed her eyes. What had gotten into him? She glanced toward Renarin, who still stood up above, on the walkway around the empty pool. He watched Adolin with unblinking sapphire eyes. He was always a little strange, but he seemed to know something she didn't. On her skirt, Pattern hummed softly. Dalinar and Navani eventually left to speak with Sabariel. Once they were gone, Shallan seized Adolin by the arm. "What's wrong?" she hissed. "You knew that dead man, didn't you? Do you know who killed him?" He looked her in the eyes.
"I have no idea who did this, Shallan. But I am going to find out."
She held his light blue eyes, weighing his gaze. Storms, what was she thinking? Adolin was a wonderful man, but he was about as deceitful as a newborn. He stalked off, and Shallan hurried after him. Renarin remained in the room, looking down the hall after them until Shallan got far enough away that over her shoulder she could no longer see him.
10. Distractions. Perhaps my heresy stretches back to those days in my childhood where these ideas began. From Oathbringer, Preface. Kaladin leaped from a hilltop, preserving Stormlight by lashing himself upward just enough to give him some lift. He soared through the rain, angled toward another hilltop. Beneath him, the valley was clogged with vivum trees, which wound their spindly branches together to create an almost impenetrable wall of forestation. He landed lightly, skidding across the wet stone past Rainspren like blue candles. He dismissed his lashing, and as the force of the ground reasserted itself, he stepped into a quick march. He'd learned to march before learning the spear or shield. Kaladin smiled. He could almost hear Hav's voice barking commands from the back of the line where he helped stragglers. Hav had always said that once men could march together, learning to fight was easy.
"Smiling?" Syl said. She'd taken the shape of a large raindrop, streaking through the air beside him, falling the wrong way.
It was a natural shape, but also completely wrong. Plausible impossibility. "You're right," Kaladin said, rain dribbling down his face. I should be more solemn. We're chasing down Voidbringers. Storms, how odd it sounded to say that. I didn't intend it as a reprimand. Hard to tell with you sometimes. And what was that supposed to mean? 2 days ago, I found that my mother is still alive, Kaladin said. So the position is not, in fact, vacant. You can stop trying to fill it. He lashed himself upward slightly, then let himself slide down the wet stone of the steep hill, standing sideways. He passed open rock buds and wiggling vines, glutted and fat from the constant rainfall. Following the weeping, they'd often find as many dead plants around the town as they did after a strong high storm.
"Well, I'm not trying to mother you," Syl said, still a raindrop.
Talking to her could be a surreal experience.
"Though perhaps I chide you on occasion, when you're being sullen," he grunted. "Or when you're being uncommunicative."
She transformed into the shape of a young woman in a hava, seated in the air and holding an umbrella as she moved along beside him.
"It is my solemn and important duty to bring happiness, light, and joy into your world when you're being a dour idiot, which is most of the time. So there."
Kaladin chuckled, holding a little stormlight as he ran up the side of the next hill, then skidded down into the next valley. This was prime farmland. There was a reason why the Akani region was prized by Satius. It might be a cultural backwater, but these rolling fields probably fed half the kingdom with their lavis and talu crops. Other villages focused on raising large passels of hogs for leather and meat. Gumfrems, a kind of chull-like beast, were less common pasture animals harvested for their gem hearts, which, though small, allowed soul-casting of meat. Syl turned into a ribbon of light and zipped in front of him, making loops. It was difficult not to feel uplifted, even in the gloomy weather. He'd spent the entire sprint to Alethkar worrying, and then assuming, that he'd be too late to save Hearthstone. To find his parents alive, well, it was an unexpected blessing, the type his life had been severely lacking. So he gave in to the urging of the stormlight. Run. Leap. Though he'd spent 2 days chasing the Voidbringers, Kaladin's exhaustion had faded. There weren't many empty beds to be found in the broken villages he passed, but he had been able to find a roof to keep him dry and something warm to eat. He'd started at Hearthstone and worked his way outward in a spiral, visiting villages, asking after the local parshmen, then warning people that the terrible storm would return. So far, he hadn't found a single town or village that had been attacked. Kaladin reached the next hilltop and pulled to a stop. A weathered stone post marked a crossroads. During his youth, he'd never gotten this far from Hearthstone, though he wasn't more than a few days' walk away. Syl zipped up to him as he shaded his eyes from the rain. The glyphs and simple map on the stone marker would indicate the distance to the next town, but he didn't need that. He could make it out as a smudge in the gloom. A fairly large town, by local standards. "Come on," he said, starting down the hillside.
"I think," Syl said, landing on his shoulder and becoming a young woman, "I would make a wonderful mother."
"And what inspired this topic?"
"You're the one who brought it up."
"In comparing Syl to his mother for nagging him? Are you even capable of having children? Baby Spren?"
"I have no idea," Syl proclaimed.
"You call the Storm Father, well, father, right? So he birthed you?"
"Maybe. I think so. Helped shape me, is more like it. Helped us find our voices."
She cocked her head.
"Yes. He made some of us. Made me."
"So maybe you could do that," Kaladin said. "Find little, bits of the wind, or of honor. Shape them." He used a lashing to leap over a snarl of rock buds and vines and startled a pack of kremlings as he landed, sending them scuttling away from a nearly clean mink skeleton, probably the leavings of a larger predator.
"Hmm," Syl said. "I would be an excellent mother. I'd teach the little Spren to fly, to coast the winds, to harass you,
Kaladin smiled. You'd get distracted by an interesting beetle and fly off, leaving them in a drawer somewhere.
Nonsense. Why would I leave my babies in a drawer? Far too boring. A High Prince's shoe, though.
He flew the remaining distance to the village, and the sight of broken buildings at the western edge dampened his mood. Though the destruction continued to be less than he'd feared, every town or village had lost people to the winds or the terrible lightning. This village, Horn Hollow, the map called it, was in what once would have been considered an ideal location. The land here dipped into a depression, and a hill to the east cut the brunt of the high storms. It held about 24 structures, including 2 large storm sanctuaries where travelers could stay, but there were also many outer buildings. This was the High Prince's land, and an industrious Dark Eyes of high enough non could get a commission to work an unused hill out by itself, then keep a portion of the crop. A few sphere lanterns gave light to the square where people had gathered for a town meeting. That was convenient. Kaladin dropped toward the lights and held his hand to the side, still formed there by unspoken command, taking the shape of a shard blade. A sleek, beautiful sword, with the symbol of the Windrunners prominent on the center, with lines sweeping off it toward the hilt, grooves in the metal that looked like flowing tresses of hair. Though Kaladin preferred a spear, the blade was a symbol. Kaladin hit the ground in the center of the village near its large central cistern, used to catch rainwater and filter away the creme. He rested the sill blade on his shoulder and stretched out his other hand, preparing his speech. "People of Horn Hollow, I am Kaladin of the Knights Radiant. I have come..."
"Lord Radiant!"
A portly, light-eyed man stumbled out of the crowd wearing a long rain cloak and a wide-brimmed hat. He looked ridiculous, but it was the weeping. Constant rain didn't exactly encourage heights of fashion. The man clapped his hands in an energetic motion, and a pair of Ardents stumbled up beside him, bearing goblets full of glowing spheres. Around the perimeter of the square, people hissed and whispered, anticipation spren flapping in an unseen wind. Several men held up small children to get a better look. "Great," Kaladin said softly. "I've become a menagerie act." In his mind, he heard Syl giggle. "Well, best to put on a good show of it." He lifted the Syl blade high overhead, prompting a cheer from the crowd. He would have bet that most of the people in this square used to curse the name of the Radiance, but none of that was manifest now in the people's enthusiasm. It was hard to believe that centuries of mistrust and vilification would be forgotten so quickly. But with the sky breaking and the land in turmoil, people would look to a symbol. Kaladin lowered his blade. He knew all too well the danger of symbols. Amaram had been one to him long ago. "You knew of my coming," Kaladin said to the city lord and the Ardents. "You've been in contact with your neighbors. Have they told you what I've been saying?"
"Yes, Bright Lord,"
the light-eyed man said, gesturing eagerly for him to take the spheres. As he did so, replacing them with spent ones he'd traded for previously, the man's expression fell noticeably. "Expected me to pay 2 for 1 as I did at the first few towns, did you?" Kaladin thought with amusement. Well, he dropped a few extra dun spheres in. He'd rather be known as generous, particularly if it helped word spread, but he couldn't have his spheres each time he went through them.
"This is good," Kaladin said, fishing out a few small gemstones. "I can't visit every holding in the area. I need you to send messages to each nearby village, carrying words of comfort and command from the king. I will pay for the time of your runners."
He looked out at the sea of eager faces and couldn't help but remember a similar day in Hearthstone, where he and the rest of the townspeople had waited, eager to catch a glimpse of their new city lord.
"Of course, Bright Lord," the light-eyed man said. "Would you wish to rest now and take a meal? Or would you rather visit the location of the attack immediately?"
"Attack?" Kaladin said, feeling a spike of alarm.
"Yes, Bright Lord," the portly light-eye said. "Isn't that why you're here? To see where the rogue Parshman assaulted us?"
"Finally. Take me there. Now!"
They'd attacked a grain storage just outside town. Squashed between two hills and shaped like a dome, it had weathered the Everstorm without so much as a loosed stone. That made it a particular shame that the Voidbringers had ripped open the door and pillaged what was inside. Kaladin knelt within, flipping over a broken hinge. The building smelled of dust and tallow, but was too wet. Townspeople who would suffer a dozen leaks in their bedroom would go to great expense to keep their grain dry. It felt odd not to have the rain on his head, though he could still hear it pattering outside.
"May I continue, Brightlord?" the Ardent asked him.
She was young, pretty, and nervous. Obviously, she didn't know where he fit into the scheme of her religion. The Knights Radiant had been founded by the Heralds, but they were also traitors. So he was either a divine being of myth, or a Cretan one step above a Voidbringer.
"Yes, please," Kaladin said.
"Of the five eyewitnesses," the Ardent said, "four, independently counted the number of attackers at 50 or so? Anyway, it's safe to say that they've got large numbers, considering how many sacks of grain they were able to carry away in such a short time. They, didn't look exactly like parshmen. Too tall and wearing armor. The sketch I made,
She tried showing him her sketch again. It wasn't much better than a child's drawing. A bunch of scribbles in vaguely humanoid shapes.
"Anyway,"
the young Ardent continued, oblivious to the fact that Syl had landed on her shoulder and was inspecting her face.
"They attacked right after first moonset. They had the grain out by middle of second moon, and we didn't hear anything until the change of guard happened. Sot raised the alarm, and that chased the creatures off. They only left four sacks, which we moved."
Kaladin took a crude wooden cudgel off the table next to the Ardent. The Ardent glanced at him, then quickly looked back to her paper, blushing. The room, lit by oil lamps, was depressingly hollow. This grain should have gotten the village to the next harvest. To a man from a farming village, nothing was more distressing than an empty silo at planting time. "The men who were attacked," Kaladin said, inspecting the cudgel, which the Voidbringers had dropped while fleeing.
"They've both recovered, Brightlord," the Ardent said. "Though Hem has a ringing in his ear he says won't go away."
50 parshmen in war form, which was what the description sounded most like to him, could easily have overrun this town and its handful of militia guards. They could have slaughtered everyone and taken whatever they wished. Instead, they'd made a surgical raid. "The red lights," Kaladin said. "Describe them again." The Ardent started. She'd been looking at him.
All five witnesses mentioned the lights, Brightlord. There were several small glowing red lights in the darkness."
"Their eyes?"
"Maybe,"
the Ardent said.
"If those were eyes, it was only a few. I went and asked, and none of the witnesses specifically saw eyes glowing, and Hem got a look right in one of the parshmen's faces as they struck him."
Kaladin dropped the cudgel and dusted off his palms. He took the sheet with the picture on it out of the young Arden's hands and inspected it, just for show, then nodded to her. "You did well. Thank you for the report." She sighed, grinning stupidly.
"Oh,"
Syl said, still on the Arden's shoulder,
"she thinks you're pretty."
Kaladin drew his lips to a line. He nodded to the woman and left her, striking back into the rain toward the center of town. Syl zipped up to his shoulder.
"Wow, she must be desperate living out here. I mean, look at you. Hair that hasn't been combed since you flew across the continent. Uniform stained with creme. And that beard."
"Thank you for the boost of confidence."
"I guess when there's nobody about but farmers, your standards really drop."
"She's an Ardent," Kaladin said. "She'd have to marry another Ardent."
"I don't think she was thinking about marriage, Kaladin," Syl said, turning and looking backward over her shoulder. "I know you've been busy lately fighting guys in white clothing and stuff, but I've been doing research."
People lock their doors, but there's plenty of room to get in underneath. I figured, since you don't seem inclined to do any learning yourself, I should study. So if you have questions...
I'm well aware of what is involved.
You sure? Syl asked. Maybe we could have that Ardent draw you a picture. She seems like she'd be really eager.
Syl,
I just want you to be happy, Kaladin, she said, zipping off his shoulder and running a few rings around him as a ribbon of light. People in relationships are happier.
That, Kaladin said, is demonstrably false. Some might be. I know a lot who aren't.
Come on, Syl said. What about that Lightweaver? You seemed to like her.
The words struck uncomfortably close to the truth. Shallan is engaged to Dalinar's son.
So? You're better than him. I don't trust him one bit.
You don't trust anyone who carries a shard blade, Syl, Kaladin said with a sigh. We've been over this. It's not a mark of bad character to have bonded one of the weapons.
Yes, well, let's have someone swing around the corpse of your sisters by the feet, and we'll see whether you consider it a mark of bad character or not. This is a distraction. Like that Lightweaver could be for you.
Shallan's a light eyes, Kaladin said. That's the end of the conversation.
But...
End, he said, stepping into the home of the village light eyes. Then he added under his breath, and stop spying on people when they're being intimate. It's creepy. The way she spoke, she expected to be there when Kaladin... Well, he'd never considered that before, though she went with him everywhere else. Could he convince her to wait outside? She'd still listen, if not sneak in to watch. Stormfather. His life just kept getting stranger. He tried... unsuccessfully, to banish the image of lying in bed with a woman, Syl sitting on the headboard and shouting out encouragement and advice.
"Lord Radiant?"
the city lord asked from inside the front room of the small home.
"Are you well?"
"Painful memory," Kaladin said. "Your scouts are certain of the direction the parchment went?" The city lord looked over his shoulder at a scraggly man in leathers, bow on his back, standing by the boarded-up window. Trapper, with a writ from the local high lord to catch mink on his lands.
"Followed them half a day out, right, lord? They never deviated. Straight toward Kolinar, I swear to Kellic himself."
"And that's where I'm going as well," Kaladin said.
"You want me to lead you, Bright Lord Radiant?"
the trapper asked. Kaladin drew in Stormlight. "Afraid you'd just slow me down." He nodded to the men, then stepped out and lashed himself upward. People clogged the road and cheered from rooftops as he left the town behind. The scents of horses reminded Adolin of his youth. Sweat and manure and hay. Good scents. Real scents. He'd spent many of those days, before he was fully a man, on campaign with his father during border skirmishes with Yaakoved. Adolin had been afraid of horses back then, though he'd never have admitted it. So much faster, more intelligent than Charles. So alien. Creatures all covered in hair, which made him shiver to touch, with big glassy eyes. And those hadn't even been real horses. For all their pedigree breeding, the horses they'd rode on campaign had just been ordinary Shin thoroughbreds. Expensive, yes, but by definition, therefore, not priceless. Not like the creature before him now. They were housing the Colin livestock in the far northwest section of the tower, on the ground floor near where winds from outside blew along the mountains. Some clever constructions in the hallways by the royal engineers had ventilated the scents away from the inner corridors, though that left the region quite chilly. Gumfrems and hogs clogged some rooms, while conventional horses stabled in others. Several even contained Bashan's axe-hounds, animals who never got to go on hunts anymore. Such accommodations weren't good enough for the Blackthorn's horse.
No, the massive black Rashadium stallion had been given his own field. Large enough to serve as a pasture, it was open to the sky, and in an enviable spot, if you discounted the sense of the other animals. As Adolin emerged from the tower, the black monster of a horse came galloping over. Big enough to carry a shard-bearer without looking small, Rashadium were often called the third shard. Blade, plate, and mount. That didn't do them justice. You couldn't earn a Rashadium simply by defeating someone in combat. They chose their riders. But, Adolin thought as Gallant nuzzled his hand, I suppose that was how it used to be with blades, too. They were Spren who chose their bearers. Hey, Adolin said, scratching the Rashadium's snout with his left hand. A little lonely out here, isn't it? I'm sorry about that. Wish you weren't alone any... He cut off as his voice caught in his throat. Gallant stepped closer, towering over him, but somehow still gentle. The horse nuzzled Adolin's neck, then blew out sharply.
Ugh,
Adolin said, turning the horse's head.
That's a scent I could do without.
He patted Gallant's neck, then reached with his right hand into his shoulder pack, before a sharp pain from his wrist reminded him yet again of his wound. He reached in with the other hand and took out some sugar lumps, which Gallant consumed eagerly.
You're as bad as Aunt Navani, Adolin noted. That's why you came running, isn't it? You smelled treats.
The horse turned his head, looking at Adolin with one watery blue eye, rectangular pupil at the center. He almost seemed offended. Adolin had often felt he could read his own Rashadium's emotions. There had been a bond between him and Sureblood, more delicate and indefinable than the bond between man and sword, but still there. Of course, Adolin was the one who talked to his sword sometimes, so he had a habit of this sort of thing.
I'm sorry, Adolin said. I know the two of you like to run together, and I don't know if Father will be able to get down as much to see you. He'd already been withdrawing from battle before he got all these new responsibilities. I thought I'd stop by once in a while.
The horse snorted loudly. Not to ride you, Adolin said, reading indignation in the Rashadium's motions. I just thought it might be nice for both of us. The horse poked his snout at Adolin's satchel until he dug out another sugar cube. It seemed like an agreement to Adolin, who fed the horse, then leaned back against the wall and watched him gallop through the pasture. Showing off, Adolin thought with amusement as Gallant pranced past him. Maybe Gallant would let him brush his coat. That would feel good, like the evenings he'd spent with Sureblood in the dark calm of the stables. At least, that was what he'd done before everything had gotten busy, with Shallan and the duels and everything else. He'd ignored the horse right up until he'd needed Sureblood in battle, and then, in a flash of light, he was gone. Adolin took a deep breath. Everything seemed insane these days. Not just Sureblood, but what he'd done to Sadeus, and now the investigation. Watching Gallant seemed to help a little. Adolin was still there, leaning against the wall, when Renarin arrived. The younger Colin poked his head through the doorway, looking around. He didn't shy away when Gallant galloped past, but he did regard the stallion with wariness.
Hey, Adolin said from the side. Hey, Bashan said you were down here.
Just checking on Gallant, Adolin said, because Father's been so busy lately.
Renarin approached.
You could ask Shallan to draw Sureblood, Renarin said. I bet, she'd be able to do a good job. To remember.
It wasn't a bad suggestion, actually.
Were you looking for me, then?
Renard watched Gallant as the horse pranced by again. He's excited.
He likes an audience.
They don't fit, you know.
Don't fit?
Rashadium have stone hooves, Renard said. Stronger than ordinary horses. Never need to be shod.
And that makes them not fit? I'd say that makes them fit better. Adolin eyed Renarin. You mean ordinary horses, don't you? Renarin blushed, then nodded. People had trouble following him sometimes, but that was merely because he tended to be so thoughtful. He'd be thinking about something deep, something brilliant, and then would only mention a part. It made him seem erratic, but once you got to know him, you realized he wasn't trying to be esoteric. His lips just sometimes failed to keep up with his brain. Adolin, he said softly, I have to give you back the shard blade you won from me.
Why?
Adolin said.
It hurts to hold, Renarin said. It always has, to be honest. I thought it was just me, being strange. But it's all of us.
Radiance, you mean? He nodded.
We can't use the dead blades. It's not right.
Well, I suppose I could find someone else to use it, Adolin said, running through options. Though you should really be the one to choose. By right of bestowal, the blade is yours, and you should pick the successor.
I'd rather you do it. I've given it to the Ardents already for safekeeping.
Which means you'll be unarmed, Adolin said. Renarin glanced away. Or not, Adolin said, then poked Renarin in the shoulder. You've got a replacement already, don't you? Renarin blushed again.
You mink, Adolin said. You've managed to create a radiant blade? Why didn't you tell us? It just happened. Gliss wasn't certain he could do it, but we need more people to work the Oath Gate, so...
He took a deep breath, then stretched his hand to the side and summoned a long, glowing shard blade. Thin, with almost no crossguard, it had waving folds to the metal, like it had been forged.
Gorgeous, Adolin said. Renarin, it's fantastic. Thanks.
So why are you embarrassed?
I'm... not?
Adolin gave him a flat stare. Renarin dismissed the blade.
I simply... Adolin, I was starting to fit in with Bridge Four, with being a shard-bearer. Now, I'm in the darkness again. Father expects me to be a Radiant so I can help him unite the world. But how am I supposed to learn?
Adolin scratched his chin with his good hand.
Huh.
I assumed that it just kind of came to you. It hasn't?
Some has, but it... frightens me, Adolin.
He held up his hand, and it started to glow, wisps of stormlight trailing off it, like smoke from a fire.
What if I hurt someone? Or ruin things?
You're not going to, Adolin said. Renarin, that's the power of the Almighty himself. Renarin only stared at that glowing hand and didn't seem convinced. So Adolin reached out with his good hand and took Renarin's, holding it.
This is good, Adolin said to him. You're not going to hurt anyone. You're here to save us.
Renarin looked to him, then smiled. A pulse of radiance washed through Adolin, and for an instant he saw himself perfected. A version of himself that was somehow complete and whole. The man he could be. It was gone in a moment, and Renarin pulled his hand free and murmured an apology. He mentioned again the shard blade needing to be given away, then fled back into the tower. Adolin stared after him. Gallant trotted up and nudged him for more sugar, so he reached absently into his satchel and fed the horse. Only after Gallant trotted off did Adolin realize he'd used his right hand. He held it up, amazed, moving his fingers. His wrist had been completely healed.
11. The Rift. 33 years ago. Dalinar danced from one foot to the other in the morning mist, feeling a new power, an energy in every step. Shardplate. His own shard plate. The world would never be the same place. They'd all expected he would someday have his own plate or blade, but he'd never been able to quiet the whisper of uncertainty from the back of his mind. What if it never happened? But it had. Stormfather, it had. He'd won it himself, in combat. Yes, that combat had involved kicking a man off a cliff, but he'd defeated a shard-bearer regardless. He couldn't help but bask in how grand it felt.
"Come, Dalinar," Sadeus said from beside him in the mist. Sadeus wore his own golden plate. "Patience."
"It won't do any good, Sadeus,"
Gavilar, clad in bright blue plate, said from Dalinar's other side. All three of them wore their faceplates up for the moment.
"The Kolin boys are chained axe-hounds, and we smell blood. We can't go into battle breathing calm breaths, centered and serene, as the Ardens teach."
Dalinar shifted, feeling the cold morning fog on his face. He wanted to dance with the anticipation spren whipping in the air around him. Behind, the army waited in disciplined ranks, their footsteps, clinkings, coughs, and murmured banter rising through the fog. He almost felt as if he didn't need that army. He wore a massive hammer on his back, so heavy an unaided man, even the strongest of them, wouldn't be able to lift it. He barely noticed the weight.
Storms, this power.
It felt remarkably like the thrill.
"Have you given thought to my suggestion, Dalinar?" Sadeus asked.
"No," Sadeus sighed.
"If Gavilar commands me," Dalinar said, "I'll marry."
"Don't bring me into this," Gavilar said. He summoned and dismissed his shardblade repeatedly as they talked.
"Well," Dalinar said, "until you say something, I'm staying single."
The only woman he'd ever wanted belonged to Gavilar. They'd married, storms they had a child now, a little girl. His brother must never know how Dalinar felt.
"But think of the benefit, Dalinar," Sadeus said. "Your wedding could bring us alliances, shards. Perhaps you could win us a princedom. One we wouldn't have to storming drive to the brink of collapse before they'd join us."
After 2 years of fighting, only 4 of the 10 princedoms had accepted Gavilar's rule, and 2 of those, Kolin and Sadeus, had been easy. The result was a united Alethkar against House Kolin. Gavilar was convinced that he could play them off one another, that their natural selfishness would lead them to stab one another in the back. Sadeus, in turn, pushed Gavilar toward greater brutality. He claimed that the fiercer their reputation, the more cities would turn to them willingly, rather than risk being pillaged.
"Well," Sadeus asked, "will you at least consider a union of political necessity?"
"Storms, you still on that?" Dalinar said. "Let me fight. You and my brother can worry about politics."
"You can't escape this forever, Dalinar. You realize that, right? We'll have to worry about feeding the Dark Eyes, about city infrastructure, about ties with other kingdoms. Politics."
"You and Gavilar," Dalinar said.
"All of us," Sadeus said. "All 3.
"Weren't you trying to get me to relax?" Dalinar snapped.
"Storms." The rising sun finally started to disperse the fog, and that let him see their target. A wall about 12 feet high. Beyond that, nothing. A flat, rocky expanse, or so it appeared. The Chasm City was difficult to spot from this direction. Named Rathalas, it was also known as the Rift, an entire city that had been built inside a rip in the ground.
"Right Lord Tanelon is a shard-bearer, right?" Dalinar asked.
Sadeus sighed, lowering his faceplate.
"We only went over this 4 times, Dalinar."
"I was drunk."
"Tanelon, shard-bearer?"
"Blade only, brother," Gavilar said.
"He's mine," Dalinar whispered. Gavilar laughed.
Only if you find him first. I've half a mind to give that blade to Sadeus. At least he listens in our meetings.
All right, Sadeus said. Let's do this carefully. Remember the plan. Gavilar, you...
Gavilar gave Dalinar a grin, slammed his faceplate down, then took off running to leave Sadeus mid-sentence. Dalinar whooped and joined him, plated boots grinding against stone. Sadeus cursed loudly, then followed. The army remained behind for the moment. Rocks started falling. Catapults from behind the wall hurled solitary boulders or sprays of smaller rocks. Chunks slammed down around Dalinar, shaking the ground, causing rockbud vines to curl up. A boulder struck just ahead, then bounced, spraying chips of stone. Dalinar skidded past it, the plate lending a spring to his motion. He raised his arm before his eye slit as a hail of arrows darkened the sky.
"Watch the ballistas!"
Gavilar shouted. Atop the wall, soldiers aimed massive crossbow-like devices mounted to the stone. One sleek bolt, the size of a spear, launched directly at Dalinar, and it proved far more accurate than the catapults. He threw himself to the side, plate grinding on stone as he slid out of the way. The bolt hit the ground with such force that the wood shattered. Other shafts trailed netting and ropes, hoping to trip a shard-bearer and render him prone for a second shot. Dalinar grinned, feeling the thrill awaken within him, and recovered his feet. He leaped over a bolt trailing netting. Tanelon's men delivered a storm of wood and stone, but it wasn't nearly enough. Dalinar took a stone in the shoulder and lurched, but quickly regained his momentum. Arrows were useless against him, the boulders too random, and the ballistas too slow to reload. This was how it should be. Dalinar, Gavilar, Sadeus, together. Other responsibilities didn't matter. Life was about the fight. A good battle in the day, then at night, a warm hearth, tired muscles, and a good vintage of wine. Dalinar reached the squat wall and leaped, propelling himself in a mighty jump. He gained just enough height to grab one of the crenels of the wall's top. Men raised hammers to pound his fingers, but he hurled himself over the lip and onto the wall walk, crashing down amid panicked defenders. He jerked the release rope on his hammer, dropping it on an enemy behind, then swung out with his fist, sending men broken and screaming. This was almost too easy. He seized his hammer, then brought it up and swung it in a wide arc, tossing men from the wall like leaves before a gust of wind. Just beyond him, Sadeus kicked over a ballista, destroying the device with a casual blow. Gavilar attacked with his blade, dropping corpses by the handful, their eyes burning. Up here, the fortification worked against the defenders, leaving them cramped and clumped up, perfect for shardbearers to destroy. Dalinar surged through them, and in a few moments likely killed more men than he had in his entire life. At that, he felt a surprising yet profound dissatisfaction. This was not about his skill, his momentum, or even his reputation. You could have replaced him with a toothless gaffer and produced practically the same result. He gritted his teeth against that sudden useless emotion. He dug deeply within and found the thrill waiting. It filled him, driving away dissatisfaction. Within moments, he was roaring his pleasure. Nothing these men did could touch him. He was a destroyer, a conqueror, a glorious maelstrom of death. A god. Sadeus was saying something. The silly man gestured in his golden shard plate. Dalinar blinked, looking out over the wall. He could see the rift proper from this vantage, a deep chasm in the ground that hid an entire city built up the sides of either cliff.
"Catapults, Dalinar," Sadeus said. "Bring down those catapults!"
Right. Gavilar's armies had started to charge the walls. Those catapults, near the way down into the rift proper, were still launching stones and would drop hundreds of men. Dalinar leaped for the edge of the wall and grabbed a rope ladder to swing down. The ropes, of course, immediately snapped, sending him toppling to the ground. He struck with a crash of plate on stone. It didn't hurt,
but his pride took a serious blow. Above, Sadeus looked at him over the edge. Dalinar could practically hear his voice. "Always rushing into things. Take some time to think once in a while, won't you?" That had been a flat-out Greenvine mistake. Dalinar growled and climbed to his feet, searching for his hammer. Storms! He'd bent the handle in his fall. How had he done that? It wasn't made of the same strange metal as blades and plate, but it was still good steel. Soldiers guarding the catapults swarmed toward him while the shadows of boulders passed overhead. Dalinar set his jaw, the thrill saturating him, and reached for a stout wooden door set into the wall nearby. He ripped it free, the hinges popping, and stumbled. It came off more easily than he'd expected. There was more to this armor than he'd ever imagined. Maybe he wasn't any better with the plate than some old gaffer, but he would change that. At that moment, he determined that he'd never be surprised again. He'd wear this plate morning and night. He'd sleep in the storming stuff, until he was more comfortable in it than out. He raised the wooden door and swung it like a bludgeon, sweeping soldiers away and opening a path to the catapults. Then he dashed forward and grabbed the side of one catapult. He ripped its wheel off, splintering wood and sending the machine teetering. He stepped onto it, grabbing the catapult's arm and breaking it free. Only 10 more to go. He stood atop the wrecked machine when he heard a distant voice call his name.
Dalinar!
He looked toward the wall, where Sadeus reached back and heaved his shardbearer's hammer. It spun in the air before slamming into the catapult next to Dalinar, wedging itself into the broken wood. Sadeus raised a hand in salute, and Dalinar waved back in gratitude, then grabbed the hammer. The destruction went a lot faster after that. He pounded the machines, leaving behind shattered wood. Engineers, many of them women, scrambled away, screaming, "Blackthorn! Blackthorn!" By the time he neared the last catapult, Gavilar had secured the gates and opened them to his soldiers. A flood of men entered, joining those who had scaled the walls. The last of the enemies near Dalinar fled down into the city, leaving him alone. He grunted and kicked the final broken catapult, sending it rolling backward across the stone toward the edge of the rift. It tipped, then fell over. Dalinar stepped forward, walking onto a kind of observation post, a section of rock with a railing to prevent people from slipping over the side. From this vantage, he got his first good look down at the city. The Rift was a fitting name. To his right, the chasm narrowed, but here at the middle, he'd have been hard-pressed to throw a stone across to the other side, even with shard plate. And within it, there was life. Gardens bobbing with lifespren, buildings built practically on top of one another down the V-shaped cliff sides. The place teemed with a network of stilts, bridges, and wooden walkways. Dalinar turned and looked back at the wall that ran in a wide circle around the opening of the rift on all sides except the west, where the canyon continued until it opened up below at the shores of the lake. To survive in Alethkar, you had to find shelter from the storms. A wide cleft like this one was perfect for a city. But how did you protect it? Any attacking enemy would have the high ground. Many cities walked a risky line between security from storms and security from men. Dalinar shouldered Sadeus's hammer as groups of Tenelon's soldiers flooded down from the walls, forming up to flank Gavilar's army on both right and left. They'd try to press against the Kolin troops from both sides, but with three shardbearers to face, they were in trouble. Where was High Lord Tenelon himself? Behind, Thaka approached with a small squad of elites, joining Dalinar on the stone viewing platform. Thaka put his hands on the railing, whistling softly.
"Something's going on with this city," Dalinar said.
"What?"
"I don't know."
Dalinar might not pay attention to the grand plans Gavilar and Sadeus made, but he was a soldier. He knew battlefields like a woman knew her mother's recipes. He might not be able to give you measurements, but he could taste when something was off. The fighting continued behind him, Kolin soldiers clashing with Tenelon's defenders. Tenelon's armies didn't fare well.
Demoralized by the advancing Kolin army, the enemy ranks quickly broke and scrambled into a retreat, clogging the ramps down into the city. Gavilar and Sadeus didn't give chase. They had the high ground now. No need to rush into a potential ambush. Gavilar clomped across the stone, Sadeus beside him. They'd want to survey the city and rain arrows upon those below. Maybe even use stolen catapults, if Dalinar had left any functional. They'd siege this place until it broke.
3 shard-bearers, Dalinar thought. Tanelon has to be planning to deal with us somehow.
This viewing platform was the best vantage for looking into the city, and they'd situated the catapults right next to it, machines that the shard-bearers were certain to attack and disable. Dalinar glanced to the sides and saw cracks in the stone floor of the viewing platform.
No!
Dalinar shouted to Gavilar.
Stay back! It's a...
The enemy must have been watching, for the moment he shouted, the ground fell out from beneath him. Dalinar caught a glimpse of Gavilar, held back by Sadeus, looking on in horror as Dalinar, Thaka, and a handful of other elites were toppled into the rift.
Storms.
The entire section of stone where they'd been standing, the lip hanging out over the rift, had broken free. As the large section of rock tumbled down into the first buildings, Dalinar was flung into the air above the city. Everything spun around him. A moment later, he crashed into a building with an awful crunch. Something hard hit his arm, an impact so powerful he heard his armor there shatter. The building failed to stop him. He tore right through the wood and continued, helm grinding against stone as he somehow came in contact with the side of the rift. He hit another surface with a loud crunch, and blessedly here he finally stopped. He groaned, feeling a sharp pain from his left hand. He shook his head and found himself staring upward some 50 feet through a shattered section of the near-vertical wooden city. The large section of falling rock had torn a swath through the city along the steep incline, smashing houses and walkways. Dalinar had been flung just to the north and had eventually come to rest on the wooden roof of a building. He didn't see signs of his men. Thaka, the other elites... But without shardplate. He growled, anger spren boiling around him like pools of blood. He shifted on the rooftop, but the pain in his hand made him wince. His armor all down his left arm had shattered, and in falling he appeared to have broken a few fingers. His shardplate leaked glowing white smoke from 100 fractures, but the only pieces he'd lost completely were from his left arm and hand. He gingerly pried himself from the rooftop, but as he shifted, he broke through and fell into the home. He grunted as he hit, members of a family screaming and pulling back against the wall. Tanelon apparently hadn't told the people of his plan to crush a section of his own city in a desperate attempt to deal with the enemy shard-bearers. Dalinar got to his feet, ignoring the cowering people, and shoved open the door, breaking it with the strength of his push, and stepped out onto a wooden walkway that ran before the homes on this tier of the city. A hail of arrows immediately fell on him. He turned his right shoulder toward them, growling, shielding his eye slit as best he could while he inspected the source of the attack. 50 archers were set up on a garden platform on the other storming side of the rift from him. Wonderful! He recognized the man leading the archers. Tall, with an imperious bearing and stark white plumes on his helm. Who put chicken feathers on their helms? Looked ridiculous. Well, Tanelon was a fine enough fellow. Dalinar had beat him once at pawns, and Tanelon had paid the bet with 100 glowing bits of ruby, each dropped into a corked bottle of wine. Dalinar had always found that amusing. Reveling in the thrill, which rose in him and drove away pain, Dalinar charged along the walkway, ignoring arrows. Above, Sadeus was leading a force down one of the ramps outside the path of the rockfall, but it would be slow going. By the time they arrived, Dalinar intended to have a new shard blade. He charged onto one of the bridges that crossed the rift. Unfortunately, he knew exactly what he would do if preparing this city for an assault. Sure enough, a pair of soldiers hurried down the other side of the rift, then used axes to attack the support posts to Dalinar's bridge. It had soul-cast metal ropes holding it up, but if they could get those posts down, dropping the lines, his weight would surely cause the entire thing to fall. The bottom wash of the rift was easily another 100 feet below. Growling, Dalinar made the only choice he could. He threw himself over the side of his walkway, dropping a short distance to one below. It looked sturdy enough. Even so, 1 foot smashed through the wooden planks, nearly followed by his entire body. He heaved himself up and continued running across. 2 more soldiers reached the posts holding up this bridge, and they began frantically hacking away. The walkway shook beneath Dalinar's feet. Stormfather, he didn't have much time. But there were no more walkways within jumping distance. Dalinar pushed himself to a run, roaring, his footfalls cracking boards. A single black arrow fell from above, swooping like a sky eel. It dropped one of the soldiers. Another arrow followed, hitting the second soldier even as he gawked at his fallen ally. The walkway stopped shaking, and Dalinar grinned, pulling to a stop. He turned, spotting a man standing near the sheared-off section of stone above. He lifted a black bow toward Dalinar.
"Teleb, you storming miracle," Dalinar said.
He reached the other side and plucked an axe from the hands of a dead man. Then he charged up a ramp toward where he'd seen High Lord Tanelon. He found the place easily, a wide wooden platform built on struts connected to parts of the wall below and draped with vines and blooming rock buds. Life sprens scattered as Dalinar reached it. Centered in the garden, Tanelon waited with a force of some 50 soldiers. Puffing inside his helm, Dalinar stepped up to confront them. Tanelon was armored in simple steel, no shard plate, though a brutal-looking shard blade, wide, with a hooked tip, appeared in his grasp. Tanelon barked for his soldiers to stand back and lower their bows. Then he strode toward Dalinar, holding the shard blade with both hands. Everyone always fixated upon shard blades. Specific weapons had lore dedicated to them, and people traced which kings or bright lords had carried which sword. Well, Dalinar had used both blade and plate, and if given the choice of one, he'd pick plate every time. All he needed to do was get in one solid hit on Tanelon, and the fight would be over. The High Lord, however, had to contend with a foe who could resist his blows. The thrill thrummed inside Dalinar. Standing between 2 squat trees, he set his stance, keeping his exposed left arm pointed away from the High Lord, while gripping the axe in his gauntleted right hand. Though it was a war axe, it felt like a child's plaything.
"You should not have come here, Dalinar," Tanelon said.
His voice bore a distinctively nasal accent common to this region. The Rifters always had considered themselves a people apart.
"We had no quarrel with you or yours."
"You refused to submit to the king," Dalinar said, armor plates clinking as he rounded the High Lord while trying to keep an eye on the soldiers.
He wouldn't put it past them to attack him once he was distracted by the duel. It was what he himself would have done.
"The king?"
Tanelon demanded, anger spren boiling up around him.
"There hasn't been a throne in Alethkar for generations. Even if we were to have a king again, who is to say the Kolins deserve the mantle?"
"The way I see it," Dalinar said, "the people of Alethkar deserve a king who is the strongest and most capable of leading them in battle. If only there were a way to prove that."
He grinned inside his helm. Tanelon attacked, sweeping in with his shard blade and trying to leverage his superior reach. Dalinar danced back, waiting for his moment. The thrill was a heady rush, a lust to prove himself. But he needed to be cautious. Ideally, Dalinar would prolong this fight, relying on his plate's superior strength and the stamina it provided. Unfortunately, that plate was still leaking, and he had all these guards to deal with. Still, he tried to play it as Tanelon would expect, dodging attacks, acting as if he were going to drag out the fight. Tanelon growled and came in again. Dalinar blocked the blow with his arm, then made a perfunctory swing with his axe. Tanelon dodged back easily. Stormfather, that blade was long. almost as tall as Dalinar was. Dalinar maneuvered, brushing against the foliage of the garden. He couldn't even feel the pain of his broken fingers anymore. The thrill called to him.
Wait. Act like you're drawing this out as long as possible.
Tenelon advanced again, and Dalinar dodged backward, faster because of his plate. And then, when Tenelon tried his next strike, Dalinar ducked toward him. He deflected the sharp blade with his arm again, but this blow hit hard, shattering the arm plate. Still, Dalinar's surprise rush let him lower his shoulder and slam it against Tenelon. The High Lord's armor clanged, bending before the force of the shard plate, and the High Lord tripped. Unfortunately, Dalinar was off balance just enough from his rush to fall alongside the High Lord. The platform shook as they hit the ground, the wood cracking and groaning. Damnation! Dalinar had not wanted to go to the ground while surrounded by foes. Still, he had to stay inside the reach of that blade. Dalinar dropped off his right gauntlet. Without the arm piece connecting it to the rest of the armor, it was dead weight, as the two of them twisted in a heap. He'd lost his axe, unfortunately. The High Lord battered against Dalinar with the pommel of his sword to no effect. But with one hand broken and the other lacking the power of plate, Dalinar couldn't get a good hold on his foe. Dalinar rolled, finally positioning himself above Tenelon, where the weight of the shard plate would keep his foe pinned. At that moment, though, the other soldiers attacked, just as he'd expected. Honorable duels like this, on a battlefield at least, always lasted only until your light eyes was losing. Dalinar rolled free. The soldiers obviously weren't ready for how quickly he responded. He got to his feet and scooped up his axe, then lashed out. His right arm still had the pauldron and down to the elbow brace, so when he swung, he had power. A strange mix of shard-enhanced strength and frailty from his exposed arms. He had to be careful not to snap his own wrist. He dropped three men with a flurry of axe slices. The others backed away, blocking him with pole arms as their fellows helped Tenelon to his feet.
"You speak of the people,"
Tenelon said hoarsely, gauntleted hand feeling at his chest where the cuirass had been bent significantly by Dalinar's rush. He seemed to be having trouble breathing.
"As if this were about them. As if it were for their good that you loot, you pillage, you murder. You're an uncivilized brute." "You can't civilize war," Dalinar said. "There's no painting it up and making it pretty."
"You don't have to pull sorrow behind you like a sledge on the stones, scraping and crushing those you pass. You're a monster."
"I'm a soldier," Dalinar said, eyeing Tenelon's men, many of whom were preparing their bows.
Tenelon coughed.
"My city is lost. My plan has failed. But I can do Alethkar one last service. I can take you down, you bastard."
The archers started to loose. Dalinar roared and threw himself to the ground, hitting the platform with the weight of shard plate. The wood cracked around him, weakened by the fighting earlier, and he broke through it, shattering struts underneath. The entire platform came crashing down around him, and together they fell toward the tier below. Dalinar heard screams, and he hit the next walkway hard enough to daze him, even with shard plate. Dalinar shook his head, groaning, and found his helm cracked right down the front, the uncommon vision granted by the armor spoiled. He pulled the helm free with one hand and gasped for breath. Storms his good arm hurt, too. He glanced at it and found splinters piercing his skin, including one chunk as long as a dagger. He grimaced. Below, the few remaining soldiers who had been positioned to cut down bridges came charging up toward him.
"Steady, Dalinar. Be ready."
He got to his feet, dazed, exhausted, but the two soldiers didn't come for him. They huddled around Tenelon's body where it had fallen from the platform above. The soldiers grabbed him, then fled. Dalinar roared and awkwardly gave pursuit. His plate moved slowly and he stumbled through the wreckage of the fallen platform, trying to keep up with the soldiers. The pain from his arms made him mad with rage. But the thrill drove him forward. He would not be beaten.
He would not stop. Tanelon's shardblade had not appeared beside his body. That meant his foe still lived. Dalinar had not yet won.
Fortunately, most of the soldiers had been positioned to fight on the other side of the city. This side was practically empty, save for huddled townspeople. He caught glimpses of them hiding in their homes. Dalinar limped up ramps along the side of the rift, following the men dragging their Bright Lord. Near the top, the two soldiers set their burden down beside an exposed portion of the chasm's rock wall. They did something that caused a portion of that wall to open inward, revealing a hidden door. They towed their fallen Bright Lord into it, and two other soldiers, responding to their frantic calls, rushed out to meet Dalinar, who arrived moments later. Helmless, Dalinar saw red as he engaged them. They bore weapons, he did not. They were fresh, and he had wounds nearly incapacitating both arms. The fight still ended with the two soldiers on the ground, broken and bleeding. Dalinar kicked open the hidden door, plated legs functioning enough to smash it down. He lurched into a small tunnel with diamond spheres glowing on the walls. That door was covered in hardened creme on the outside, making it seem like a part of a wall. If he hadn't seen them enter, it would have taken days, maybe weeks, to locate this place. At the end of a short walk, he found the two soldiers he'd followed. Judging by the blood trail, they'd deposited their Bright Lord in the closed room behind them. They rushed Dalinar with the fatalistic determination of men who knew they were probably dead. The pain in Dalinar's arms and head seemed nothing before the thrill. He had rarely felt it so strong as he did now. A beautiful clarity. Such a wonderful emotion. He ducked forward, supernaturally quick, and used his shoulder to crush one soldier against the wall. The other fell to a well-placed kick. Then Dalinar burst through the door beyond them. Tanelon lay on the ground here, blood surrounding him. A beautiful woman was draped across him, weeping. Only one other person was in the small chamber. A young boy. 6, perhaps 7. Tears streaked the child's face, and he struggled to lift his father's shard blade in two hands. Dalinar loomed in the doorway.
"You can't have my daddy,"
the boy said, words distorted by his sorrow. Pain sprang crawled around the floor.
"You can't! You...
His voice fell to a whisper.
"Daddy said... we fight monsters, and with faith, we will win."
A few hours later, Dalinar sat on the edge of the rift, his legs swinging over the broken city below. His new shard blade rested across his lap, his plate, deformed and broken, in a heap beside him. His arms were bandaged, but he'd chased away the surgeons. He stared out at what seemed an empty plain, then flicked his eyes toward the signs of human life below. Dead bodies in heaps. Broken buildings. Splinters of civilization. Gavilar eventually walked up, trailed by two bodyguards from Dalinar's elites, Kadash and Febin, today. Gavilar waved them back, then groaned as he settled down beside Dalinar, removing his helm. Exhaustion Spren spun overhead, though, despite his fatigue, Gavilar looked thoughtful. With those keen, pale-green eyes, he'd always seemed to know so much. Growing up, Dalinar had simply assumed that his brother would always be right in whatever he said or did. Aging hadn't much changed his opinion of the man.
"Congratulations," Gavilar said, nodding toward the blade. "Sadius is irate it wasn't his."
"He'll find one of his own eventually," Dalinar said. "He's too ambitious for me to believe otherwise."
Gavilar grunted.
"This attack nearly cost us too much. Sadius is saying we need to be more careful. Not risk ourselves and our shards in solitary assaults."
"Sadius is smart," Dalinar said.
He reached gingerly with his right hand, the less mangled one, and raised a mug of wine to his lips. It was the only drug he cared about for the pain. and maybe it would help with the shame, too. Both feelings seemed stark, now that the thrill had receded and left him deflated.
"What do we do with them, Dalinar?" Gavilar asked, waving down toward the crowds of civilians the soldiers were rounding up.
"Tens of thousands of people. They won't be cowed easily. They won't like that you killed their High Lord and his heir. These people will resist us for years.
I can feel it." Dalinar took a drink. "Make soldiers of them," he said. "Tell them we'll spare their families if they fight for us. You want to stop doing a Shardbearer rush at the start of battles? Sounds like we'll need some expendable troops."
Gavilar nodded, considering. "Sadius is right about other things, too, you know. About us. And what we're going to have to become."
"Don't talk to me about that."
"Dalinar, I lost half my elites today. My captain included. I've got enough problems."
"Why are we here, fighting? Is it for honor? Is it for Alethkar?"
Dalinar shrugged.
"We can't just keep acting like a bunch of thugs," Gavilar said. "We can't rob every city we pass, feast every night. We need discipline. We need to hold the land we have. We need bureaucracy, order, laws, politics."
Dalinar closed his eyes, distracted by the shame he felt. What if Gavilar found out?
"We're going to have to grow up," Gavilar said softly.
"And become soft, like these High Lords we kill? That's why we started, isn't it? Because they were all lazy, fat, corrupt?
I don't know anymore. I'm a father now, Dalinar. That makes me wonder about what we do once we have it all. How do we make a kingdom of this place?"
Storms. A kingdom? For the first time in his life, Dalinar found that idea horrifying. Gavilar eventually stood up, responding to some messengers who were calling for him.
"Could you," he said to Dalinar, "at least try to be a little less foolhardy in future battles?"
"This coming from you?"
"A thoughtful me," Gavilar said. "An exhausted me. Enjoy Oathbringer. You earned it."
"Oathbringer?"
"Your sword," Gavilar said.
"Storms, didn't you listen to anything last night? That's Sunmaker's old sword."
Sadies, the Sunmaker. He had been the last man to unite Alethkar, centuries ago.
Dalinar shifted the blade in his lap, letting the light play off the pristine metal.
"It's yours now," Gavilar said. "By the time we're done, I'll have it so that nobody even thinks of Sunmaker anymore. Just House Colin and Alethkar."
He walked away. Dalinar rammed the shard blade into the stone and leaned back, closing his eyes again, and remembering the sound of a brave boy crying.
12. Negotiations. "I ask not that you forgive me, nor that you even understand." From Oathbringer, Preface.
Dalinar stood beside the glass windows in an upper floor room of Uathiru, hands clasped behind his back. He could see his reflection hinted in the window, and beyond it, vast openness. The sky cloud-free, the sun burning white. Windows as tall as he was, he'd never seen anything like them. Who would dare build something of glass, so brittle, and face it toward the storms? But of course, this city was above the storms. These windows seemed a mark of defiance, a symbol of what the radiance had meant. They had stood above the pettiness of world politics, and because of that height, they could see so far.
"You idealize them," said a distant voice in his head, like rumbling thunder. "They were men like you, no better, no worse."
"I find that encouraging," Dalinar whispered back. "If they were like us, then it means we can be like them."
"They eventually betrayed us. Do not forget that."
"Why?" Dalinar asked. "What happened? What changed them?" The Stormfather fell silent.
"Please," Dalinar said, "tell me." "Some things are better left forgotten," the voice said to him. "You, of all men, should understand this, considering the hole in your mind and the person who once filled it."
Dalinar drew in a sharp breath, stung by the words.
"Bright Lord," Brightness Calamy said from behind, "the Emperor is ready for you."
Dalinar turned. Eurytheru's upper levels held several unique rooms, including this amphitheater. Shaped like a half-moon, the room had windows at the top, the straight side, then rows of seats leading down to a speaking floor below. Curiously, each seat had a small pedestal beside it, for the Radiance Spren, the Stormfather told him. Dalinar started down the steps toward his team. Aladar and his daughter May, Navani, wearing a bright green hava, sitting in the front row with feet stretched out before her, shoes off and ankles crossed. Elderly Calami to right, and Teshev Kal, one of Alethkar's finest political minds, to advise. Her two senior wards sat beside her, ready to provide research or translation if needed. A small group, prepared to change the world.
"Send my greetings to the Emperor," Dalinar instructed.
Calami nodded, writing. Then she cleared her throat, reading the response that the span read, writing as if on its own, relayed.
"You are greeted by His Imperial Majesty, Chief V.D. Yanagon I, Emperor of Makabak, King of Aesir, Lord of the Bronze Palace, Prime Akasix, Grand Minister and Emissary of Aesir."
"An imposing title," Navani noted. "For a 15-year-old boy."
"He supposedly raised a child from the dead," Teshev said. "A miracle that gained him the support of the viziers. Local word is that they had trouble finding a new prime after the last two were murdered by our old friend the assassin in white. So the viziers picked a boy with questionable lineage and made up a story about him saving someone's life in order to demonstrate a divine mandate."
Dalinar grunted. "Making things up doesn't sound very Aesish."
"They're fine with it," Navani said, "as long as you can find witnesses willing to fill out affidavits. Calami, thank His Imperial Majesty for meeting with us and his translators for their efforts."
Calami wrote, and then she looked up at Dalinar, who began to pace the center of the room. Navani stood to join him, eschewing her shoes, walking in socks.
"Your Imperial Majesty," Dalinar said. "I speak to you from the top of Eurytheru, City of Legend. The sights are breathtaking. I invite you to visit me here and tour the city. You are welcome to bring any guards or retinue you see fit."
He looked to Navani, and she nodded. They'd discussed long how to approach the monarchs and had settled on a soft invitation. Aesir was first, the most powerful country in the West, and home to what would be the most central and important of the Oath Gates to secure. The response took time. The Aesish government was a kind of beautiful mess, though Gavilar had often admired it. Layers of clerics filled all levels, where both men and women wrote. Scions were kind of like ardents, though they weren't slaves, which Dalinar found odd. In Aesir, being a priest minister in the government was the highest honor to which one could aspire. Traditionally, the Aesish prime claimed to be emperor of all Makabak. a region that included over a half dozen kingdoms and princedoms. In reality, he was king over only Aesir, but Aesir did cast a long, long shadow. As they waited, Dalinar stepped up beside Nabani, resting his fingers on one of her shoulders, then drew them across her back, the nape of her neck, and let them linger on the other shoulder. Who would have thought a man his age could feel so giddy? "Your Highness," the reply finally came, Calame reading the words. "We thank you for your warning about the storm that blew from the wrong direction. Your timely words have been noted and recorded in the official annals of the Empire, recognizing you as a friend to Aesir." Calame waited for more, but the span reed stopped moving. Then the ruby flashed, indicating that they were done.
"That wasn't much of a response," Aladar said. "Why didn't he reply to your invitation, Dalinar?"
"Being noted in their official records is a great honor to the Aesish," Teshav said. "So they've paid you a compliment."
"Yes," Nabani said, "but they are trying to dodge the offer we made. Press them, Dalinar."
"Calame, please send the following," Dalinar said. "I am honored, though I wish my inclusion in your annals could have been due to happier circumstances. Let us discuss the future of Roshar together, here. I am eager to make your personal acquaintance."
They waited as patiently as they could for a response. It finally came in Alethi.
"We of the Aesish crown are saddened to share mourning for the fallen with you. As your noble brother was killed by the Shin Destroyer, so were beloved members of our court. This creates a bond between us."
That was all. Nabani clicked her tongue.
"They're not going to be pushed into an answer."
"They could at least explain themselves," Dalinar snapped. "It feels like we're having two different conversations."
"The Aesish," Teshav said, "do not like to give offense. They're almost as bad as the Emuli in that regard, particularly with foreigners."
It wasn't only an Aesish attribute in Dalinar's estimation. It was the way of politicians worldwide. Already this conversation was starting to feel like his efforts to bring the High Princes to his side back in the war camps. Half answer after half answer, mild promises with no bite to them, laughing eyes that mocked him even while they pretended to be perfectly sincere. Storms. Here he was again, trying to unite people who didn't want to listen to him. He couldn't afford to be bad at this, not any longer.
"There was a time," he thought, "when I united in a different way."
He smelled smoke, heard men screaming in pain, remembered bringing blood and ash to those who defied his brother. Those memories had become particularly vivid lately.
"Another tactic, maybe?" Nabani suggested. "Instead of an invitation, try an offer of aid."
"Your Imperial Majesty," Dalinar said, "war is coming. Surely you have seen the changes in the Parshmen. The Voidbringers have returned. I would have you know that the Alethi are your allies in this conflict. We would share information regarding our successes and failures in resisting this enemy, with hope that you'll report the same to us. Mankind must be unified in the face of the mounting threat."
The reply eventually came,
"We agree that aiding one another in this new age will be of the utmost importance. We are glad to exchange information. What do you know of these transformed Parshmen?"
"We engaged them on the Shattered Plains," Dalinar said, relieved to make some kind of headway. "Creatures with red eyes, and similar in many ways to the Parshmen we found on the Shattered Plains, only more dangerous. I will have my scribes prepare reports for you detailing all we have learned in fighting the Parshendi over the years."
"Excellent," the reply finally came. "This information will be extremely welcome in our current conflict."
"What is the status of your cities?" Dalinar asked. "What have the Parshmen been doing there? Do they seem to have a goal beyond wanton destruction?"
Tensely, they waited for word. So far, they'd been able to discover blessed little about the Parshmen the world over. Captain Kaladin sent reports using scribes from towns he visited, but knew next to nothing. Cities were in chaos, and reliable information scarce.
"Fortunately," came the reply, "our city stands, and the enemy is not actively attacking any longer. We are negotiating with the hostiles."
"Negotiating?" Dalinar said, shocked.
He turned to Teshev, who shook her head in wonder.
"Please clarify, Your Majesty," Navani said. "The Voidbringers are willing to negotiate with you?"
"Yes," came the reply. "We are exchanging contracts. They have very detailed demands with outrageous stipulations. We hope that we can forestall armed conflict in order to gather ourselves and fortify the city."
"They can write?" Navani pressed. "The Voidbringers themselves are sending you contracts?"
"The average Parshman cannot write, so far as we can tell," the reply came. "But some are different, stronger, with strange powers. They do not speak like the others."
"Your Majesty," Dalinar said, stepping up to the span reed writing table, speaking more urgently, as if the Emperor and his ministers could hear his passion through the written word. "I need to talk to you directly. I can come myself through the portal we wrote of earlier. We must get it working again."
Silence. It stretched so long that Dalinar found himself grinding his teeth, itching to summon a shard blade and dismiss it over and over, as had been his habit as a youth. He'd picked it up from his brother. A response finally came.
"We regret to inform you that the device you mention," Calamy read, "is not functional in our city. We have investigated it and have found that it was destroyed long ago. We cannot come to you, nor you to us. Many apologies."
"He's telling us this now?" Dalinar said. "Storms, that's information we could have used as soon as he learned it."
"It's a lie," Navani said. "The oath gate on the Shattered Plains functioned after centuries of storms and Krem buildup. The one in Azamir is a monument in the Grand Market, a large dome in the center of the city."
Or so she'd determined from maps. The one in Kolinar had been incorporated into the palace structure, while the one in Thalen City was some kind of religious monument. A beautiful relic like this wouldn't simply be destroyed.
"I agree with Brightness Navani's assessment," Teshev said. "They are worried about the idea of you or your armies visiting. This is an excuse."
She frowned as if the Emperor and his ministers were little more than spoiled children disobeying their tutors. The Spanreed started writing again.
"What does it say?" Dalinar said, anxious.
"It's an affidavit," Navani said, amused. "That the Oath Gate is not functioning, signed by Imperial Architects and Storm Wardens."
She read further.
"Oh, this is delightful. Only the Azish would assume you'd want certification that something is broken."
"Notably," Calamy added, "it only certifies that the device does not function as a portal. But of course it would not. Not unless a Radiant were to visit and work it. This affidavit basically says that when turned off, the device doesn't work."
"Write this, Calamy," Dalinar said. "Your Majesty, you ignored me once. Destruction caused by the Everstorm was the result. Please, this time listen. You cannot negotiate with the Voidbringers. We must unify, share information, and protect Roshar. Together."
She wrote it, and Dalinar waited, hands pressed against the table.
"We misspoke when we mentioned negotiations," Calamy read. "It was a mistake of translation. We agree to share information, but time is short right now. We will contact you again to further discuss. Farewell, High Prince Kolin."
"Bah!" Dalinar said, pushing himself back from the table. "Fools! Idiots! Storming Light Eyes and damnation's own politics!"
He stalked across the room, wishing he had something to kick, before forcing his temper under control.
"That's more of a stone wall than I expected," Navani said, folding her arms. "Brightness, Karl?"
"In my experiences with the Azish," Teshev said, "they are extremely proficient at saying very little in as many words as possible. This is not an unusual example of communication with their upper ministers. Don't be put off. It will take time to accomplish anything with them."
"Time during which Roshar burns," Delinar said. "Why did they pull back regarding their claim to have had negotiations with the Voidbringers? Are they thinking of allying themselves to the enemy?"
"I hesitate to guess," Teshev said, "but I would say that they simply decided they'd given away more information than intended."
"We need Azir," Dalinar said. "Nobody in Makabuk will listen to us unless we have Azir's blessing, not to mention that Oathgate."
He trailed off as a different span read on the table started blinking.
"It's the Thalens," Calamy said. "They're early."
"You want to reschedule?" Navani asked.
Dalinar shook his head.
"No. We can't afford to wait another few days before the Queen can spare time again."
He took a deep breath. Storms talking to politicians was more exhausting than a 100-mile march in full armor.
"Proceed, Calamy. I'll contain my frustration."
Navani settled down on one of the seats, though Dalinar remained standing. Light poured in through the windows, pure and bright. It flowed down, bathing him. He breathed in, almost feeling as if he could taste the sunlight. He'd spent too many days inside the twisting stone corridors of Yuvathiru, lit by the frail light of candles and lamps.
"Her Royal Highness," Calamy read, "Brightness Fenranandi, Queen of Thalinar, writes to you."
Calamy paused.
"Bright Lord, pardon the interruption, but that indicates that the Queen holds the span reed herself, rather than using a scribe."
To another woman, that would have been intimidating. To Calamy, it was merely one of many footnotes, which she added copiously to the bottom of the page before preparing the reed to relay Dalinar's words.
"Your Majesty," Dalinar said, clasping his hands behind his back and pacing the stage at the center of the seats. "Do better. Unite them. I send you greetings from Yuvathiru, holy city of the Knights Radiant, and extend to you our humblest invitation. This tower is truly a sight to behold, matched only by the glory of a sitting monarch. I would be honored to present it for you to experience."
The span reed quickly scribbled a reply. Queen Fen was writing directly in Alethi.
"Colin," Calamy read, "you old brute, quit spreading chalscat. What do you really want?"
"I always did like her,"
Navani noted.
"I'm being sincere, Your Majesty," Dalinar said. "My only desire is for us to meet in person and to talk to you and show you what we've discovered. The world is changing around us."
"Oh," came the reply. "The world is changing, is it? What led you to this incredible conclusion? Was it the fact that our slaves suddenly became Voidbringers? Or was it perhaps the storm that blew the wrong way?" She wrote that twice as large as the line around it, Bright Lord. "Ripping our cities apart?"
Aladar cleared his throat.
"Her Majesty seems to be having a bad day."
"She's insulting us," Navani said. "For Fen, that actually implies a good day."
"She's always been perfectly civil the few times I've met her," Dalinar said with a frown.
"She was being queenly then,"
Navani said.
"You've got her talking to you directly. Trust me, it's a good sign."
"Your Majesty," Dalinar said, "please tell me of your parchment. The transformation came upon them?"
"Yes," she replied. "Storming monsters stole our best ships, almost everything in the harbor from single-masted sloops on up, and escaped the city."
"They sailed?"
Dalinar said, again shocked.
"Confirm. They didn't attack?"
There were some scuffles, Fenn wrote, but most everyone was too busy dealing with the effects of the storm. By the time we got things somewhat sorted out, they were sailing away in a grand fleet of royal warships and private trading vessels alike.
Dalinar drew a breath. We don't know half as much about the Voidbringers as we assumed.
Your Majesty, he continued, you might remember that we warned you about the imminent arrival of that storm.
I believed you, Fenn said, if only because we got word from New Natanen confirming it. We tried to prepare, but a nation cannot upend 4 millennia worth of tradition at a snap of the fingers. Balin City is a shambles, Colin. The storm broke our aqueducts and sewer systems, and ripped apart our docks, flattened the entire outer market. We have to fix all our cisterns, reinforce our buildings to withstand storms, and rebuild society, all without any parchment laborers and in the middle of the storming weeping. I don't have time for sightseeing.
It's hardly sightseeing, Your Majesty, Dalinar said. I am aware of your problems, and dire though they are, we cannot ignore the Voidbringers. I intend to convene a grand conference of kings to fight this threat.
Led by you, Fenn wrote in reply. Of course.
Urethiru is the natural location for a meeting, Dalinar said. Your Majesty, the Knights Radiant have returned. We speak again their ancient oaths and bind the surges of nature to us. If we can restore your oath gate to functionality, you can be here in an afternoon and return the same evening to direct the needs of your city.
Navani nodded at this tactic, though Aladar folded his arms, looking thoughtful.
What? Dalinar asked him as Calamy wrote. We need a radiant to travel to the city to activate their oath gate, right? Aladar asked.
Yes, Navani said. A radiant needs to unlock the gate on this side, which we can do at any moment. Then one has to travel to the destination city and undo the lock there as well. That done, a radiant can initiate a transfer from either location.
Then the only one we have that can theoretically get to Thalen City is the Windrunner, Aladar said. But what if it takes him months to get back here? Or what if he's captured by the enemy? Can we even make good on our promises, Dalinar?
A troubling problem, but one that Dalinar thought he might have an answer to. There was a weapon that he'd decided to keep hidden for now. It might work as well as a Radiant's Shardblade in opening the Oath Gates, and might let someone reach Thalen City by flight. That was moot for the time being. First he needed a willing ear on the other side of the Span Reed. Fenn's reply came.
I will admit that my merchants are intrigued by these oath gates. We have lore surrounding them, that the one most passionate could cause the portal of worlds to open again. I think every girl in Thalena dreams of being the one to invoke it.
The passions, Navani said with a downward turn of her lips. The Thalens had a pagan pseudo-religion, and that had always been a curious aspect in dealing with them. They would praise the heralds one moment, then speak of the passions the next. Well, Dalinar wasn't one to fault another for unconventional beliefs.
If you want to send me what you know about these oath gates, well, that sounds great, Fenn continued. But I'm not interested in some grand conference of kings. You let me know what you boys come up with, because I'm going to be here frantically trying to rebuild my city.
Well, Aladar said, at least we finally got an honest response.
I'm not convinced this is honest, Dalinar said.
He rubbed his chin, thinking. He'd only met this woman a few times, but something seemed off about her responses.
I agree, Bright Lord, Teshuv said. I think any Thalen would jump at the chance to come pull strings at a meeting of monarchs, if only to see if she can find a way to get trade deals out of them. She is most certainly hiding something.
Offer troops, Navani said, to help her rebuild.
Your Majesty, Dalinar said, I am deeply grieved to hear of your losses. I have many soldiers here who are currently unoccupied. I would gladly send you a battalion to help repair your city.
The reply was slow in coming.
I'm not sure what I think of having Alethi troops on my stone, well-intentioned or not.
Aladar grunted.
She's worried about invasion? Everyone knows Alethian ships don't mix.
She's not worried about us arriving on ships, Dalinar said. She's worried about an army of troops suddenly materializing in the center of her city.
A very rational worry. If Dalinar had the inclination, he could send a Windrunner to secretly open a city's oath gate and invade in an unprecedented assault that appeared right behind enemy lines. He needed allies, not subjects. So he wouldn't do it. At least, not to a potential friendly city. Kolinar, however, was another story. They still didn't have reliable word of what was happening in the Alethi capital. But if the rioting was still going on, he'd been thinking that there might be a way to get armies in and restore order. For now, he needed to focus on Queen Fen.
Your Majesty, he said, nodding for Calamy to write, consider my offer of troops, please. And as you do, might I suggest that you begin searching among your people for budding Knights Radiant? They are the key to working Oath Gates.
We have had a number of Radiants manifest near the Shattered Plains. They are formed through an interaction with certain Spren, who seem to be searching for worthy candidates. I can only assume this is happening worldwide. It is entirely likely that among the people of your city someone has already spoken the oaths.
You are giving up quite an advantage, Dalinar, Aladar noted.
I'm planting a seed, Aladar, Dalinar said, and I'll plant it on any hill I can find, regardless of who owns it. We must fight as a unified people.
I don't dispute that, Aladar said, standing up and stretching. But your knowledge of the Radiance is a bargaining point, one that can perhaps draw people to you, force them to work with you. Give up too much and you might find a headquarters for the Knights Radiant in every major city across Roshar. Rather than working together, you'll have them competing to recruit.
He was right, unfortunately. Dalinar hated turning knowledge into bargaining chips, but what if this was why he'd always failed in his negotiations with the High Princes? He wanted to be honest, straightforward, and let the pieces fall where they may. But it seemed that someone better at the game, and more willing to break the rules, always snatched the pieces from the air as he dropped them, then set them down the way they wanted.
And, he said quickly for Calamy to add, we would be happy to send our Radiance to train those you discover, then introduce them to the system and fraternity of Urethiru, to which each of them has a right by nature of their oaths.
Calamy added this, then twisted the span reed to indicate they were done and waiting for a reply.
We will consider this, Calamy read as the span reed scribbled across the page. The Crown of Thelenor thanks you for your interest in our people, and we will consider negotiations regarding your offer of troops. We have sent some of our few remaining cutters to track down the fleeing Parshmen and will inform you of what we discover. Until we speak again, High Prince.
Storms, Navani said. She reverted to Queen speak. We lost her somewhere in there.
Dalinar sat down in the seat next to her and let out a long sigh.
Dalinar, she said.
I'm fine, Navani, he said. I can't expect glowing commitments to cooperation on my first attempt. We'll just have to keep trying.
The words were more optimistic than he felt. He wished he could talk to these people in person instead of over Spanreed. They talked to the Princess of Ysir next, followed by the Prince of Tashik. They didn't have oath gates and were less essential to his plan, but he wanted to at least open lines of communication with them. Neither gave him more than vague answers. Without the Azish Emperor's blessing, he wouldn't be able to get any of the smaller Makabaki kingdoms to commit. Perhaps the Imuli or the Tukari would listen. But he'd only ever get one of those two, considering their long-standing feud. At the end of the last conference, Aladar and his daughter excusing themselves, Dalinar stretched, feeling worn down. and this wasn't the end of it. He would have discussions with the monarchs of Eri. It had three, strangely. The Oathgate at Ral Elorim was in their lands, making them important, and they held sway over nearby Rira, which had another Oathgate. Beyond that, of course, there were the Shin to deal with. They hated using span reeds, so Navani had poked at them through a Thalen merchant who had been willing to relay information. Dalinar's shoulder protested as he stretched. He had found middle age to be like an assassin, quiet, creeping along behind him. Much of the time he would go about his life as he always had until an unexpected ache or pain gave warning. He was not the youth he had once been. "And bless the Almighty for that," he thought idly, bidding farewell to Navani, who wanted to sift through information reports from various spanreed stations around the world. Aladar's daughter and scribes were gathering them in bulk for her. Dalinar collected several of his guards, leaving others for Navani should she need some extra hands, and climbed up along the rows of seats to the room's exit at the top. Hovering just outside the doorway, like an axe hound banished from the warmth of the fire, stood Elikar.
"Your Majesty," Dalinar said, starting, "I'm glad you could make the meeting. Are you feeling better?"
"Why do they refuse you, Uncle?" Elikar asked, ignoring the question. "Do they think perhaps you will try to usurp their thrones?"
Dalinar drew in his breath sharply, and his guards looked embarrassed to be standing nearby. They backed up to give him and the king privacy.
"Elikar," Dalinar said.
"You likely think I say this in spite," the king said, poking his head into the room, noting his mother, then looking back at Dalinar. "I don't. You are better than I am. A better soldier, a better person, and certainly a better king."
"You do yourself a disservice, Elikar. You must—"
"Oh, save your platitudes, Dalinar. For once in your life, just be honest with me."
"You think I haven't been?"
Elikar raised his hand and lightly touched his own chest.
"Perhaps you have been, at times. Perhaps the liar here is me, lying to tell myself I could do this, that I could be a fraction of the man my father was. No, don't interrupt, Dalinar. Let me have my say. Void bringers? Ancient cities full of wonder? The desolations?"
Elikar shook his head.
Perhaps I'm a fine king. Not extraordinary, but not an abject failure. But in the face of these events, the world needs better than fine."
There seemed a fatalism to his words, and that sent a worried shiver through Dalinar.
"Elikar, what are you saying?"
Elikar strode into the chamber and called down to those at the bottom of the rows of seats.
"Mother? Brightness Teshav, would you witness something for me?"
"Storms, no," Dalinar thought, hurrying after Elikar. "Don't do this, son."
"We all must accept the consequences of our actions, Uncle," Elikar said. "I've been learning this very slowly, as I can be as dense as a stone. But—" "Uncle, am I your king?" Elikar demanded.
"Yes."
"Well, I shouldn't be."
He knelt, shocking Navani and causing her to pull to a stop 3/4 of the way up the steps.
"Dalinar Kholin," Elikar said in a loud voice, "I swear to you now, there are princes and high princes. Why not kings and high kings? I give an oath, immutable and witnessed, that I accept you as my monarch. As Alethkar is to me, I am to you."
Dalinar breathed out, looking to Navani's aghast face, then down to his nephew, kneeling as a vassal on the floor.
"You did ask for this, Uncle," Elikar said. "Not specifically in words, but it is the only place we could have gone. You have slowly been taking command ever since you decided to trust those visions."
"I've tried to include you," Dalinar said.
Silly, impotent words. He should be better than that.
"You are right, Elikar. I'm sorry."
"Are you?" Elikar asked. "Are you really?"
"I'm sorry," Dalinar said, "for your pain. I'm sorry that I didn't handle this better. I'm sorry that this must be.
Before you make this oath, tell me what you expect that it entails.
I've already said the words, Elokar said, growing red-faced. Before witnesses. It is done.
Oh, stand up, Dalinar said, grabbing him by the arm and hauling him to his feet. Don't be dramatic. If you really want to swear this oath, I'll let you. But let's not pretend you can sweep into a room, shout a few words, and assume it's a legal contract.
Elokar pulled his arm free and rubbed it.
Won't even let me abdicate with dignity.
You're not abdicating, Navani said, joining them.
She shot a glare at the guards, who stood watching with slack jaws, and they grew white at the glare. She pointed at them as if to say not a word of this to anyone else.
Elokar, you intend to shove your uncle into a position above you. He's right to ask. What will this mean for Alethkar?
Elokar swallowed.
He should give up his lands to his heir. Dalinar is a king of somewhere else, after all. Dalinar? High king of Urethiru. Maybe the Shattered Plains.
He stood straighter, speaking more certainly.
Dalinar must stay out of the direct management of my lands. He can give me commands, but I decide how to see them accomplished.
It sounds reasonable,
Navani said, glancing at Dalinar. Reasonable, but gut-wrenching. The kingdom he'd fought for, the kingdom he'd forged in pain, exhaustion, and blood, now rejected him.
This is my land now, Dalinar thought. This tower covered in cold spren. I can accept these terms, though at times I might need to give commands to your high princes.
As long as they're in your domain, Elokar said, a hint of stubbornness to his voice, I consider them under your authority. While they visit Urethiru, or the Shattered Plains, command as you wish. When they return to my kingdom, you must go through me.
He looked at Dalinar and then glanced down, as if embarrassed to be making demands.
Very well, Dalinar said, though we need to work this out with scribes before we make the change officially. And before we go too far, we should make certain there is still an Alethkar for you to rule.
I've been thinking the same thing, Uncle. I want to lead our forces to Alethkar and recapture our homeland. Something is wrong in Kulinar. More than these riots or my wife's supposed behavior. More than the Spanreeds going still. The enemy is doing something in the city. I'll take an army to stop it and save the kingdom.
Elokar? Leading troops? Dalinar had been imagining himself leading a force, cutting through the Voidbringer ranks, sweeping them from Alethkar and marching into Kulinar to restore order. Truth was, though, it didn't make sense for either of them to lead such an assault.
Elokar, Dalinar said, leaning in, I've been considering something. The Oath Gate is attached to the palace itself. We don't need to march an army all the way to Alethkar. All we need to do is restore that device. Once it works, we can transport our forces into the city to secure the palace, restore order, and fend off the Voidbringers.
Get into the city, Elokar said. Uncle, to do that, we might need an army in the first place.
No, Dalinar said. A small team could reach Kulinar far faster than an army. As long as there was a Radiant with them, they could sneak in, restore the Oath Gate, and open the way for the rest of us.
Elokar perked up.
Yes. I'll do it, Uncle. I'll take a team and reclaim our home. Aesudan is there. If the rioting is still happening, she's fighting against it.
That wasn't what the reports, before they'd cut off, had suggested to Dalinar. If anything, the Queen was the cause of the riots. And he certainly hadn't been intending Elokar to go on this mission himself.
Consequences. The lad was earnest, as he'd always been. Besides, Elokar seemed to have learned something from his near death at the hands of assassins. He was certainly humbler now than he'd been in years past.
It is fitting, Dalinar said, that their king should be the one who saves them. I will see that you have whatever resources you need, Elokar.
Glowing glory spren orbs burst around Elokar. He grinned at them.
I only seem to see those when I'm around you, Uncle. Funny. For all that I should resent you, I don't. It's hard to resent a man who is doing his best. I'll do it. I'll save Alethkar. I need one of your radiants. The hero, preferably.
The hero?
The bridgeman, Elokar said. The soldier. He needs to go with me, so if I screw up and fail, someone will be there to save the city anyway.
Dalinar blinked. That's very,
I've had ample chances to reflect lately, Uncle, Elokar said. The Almighty has preserved me despite my stupidity. I'll bring the bridgeman with me and I'll observe him. Figure out why he's so special. See if he'll teach me to be like him. And if I fail? He shrugged. Well, Alethkar is in safe hands regardless, right?
Dalinar nodded, bemused.
I need to make plans, Elokar said. I've only just recovered from my wounds, but I can't leave until the hero returns anyway. Could he fly me and my chosen team to the city? That would certainly be the fastest way. I will want every report we've had from Kolinar, and I need to study the Oathgate device in person. Yes, and have drawings done comparing it to the one in the city, and...
He beamed.
Thank you, Uncle. Thank you for believing in me. If only this small amount.
Dalinar nodded to him, and Elokar retreated, a spring in his step. Dalinar sighed, feeling overwhelmed by the exchange. Navani hovered by his side as he settled down in one of the seats for the Radiance, beside a pedestal for a little spren. On one side he had a king swearing to him an oath he didn't want. On the other, he had an entire group of monarchs who wouldn't listen to his most rational of suggestions. Storms.
Dalinar? Calamy said. Dalinar!
He leaped to his feet, and Navani spun. Calamy was watching one of the span reeds which had started writing. What was it now? What terrible news awaited him?
Your Majesty, Calamy read from the page, I consider your offer generous and your advice wise. We have located the device you call an oath gate. One of my people has come forward and, remarkably, claims to be radiant. Her spren directed her to speak with me. We plan to use her shard blade to test the device. If it works, I will come to you in all haste. It is well that someone is attempting to organize a resistance to the evils that befall us. The nations of Roshar must put aside their squabbles, and the reemergence of the holy city of Urethiru is proof to me that the Almighty guides your hand. I look forward to counseling with you and adding my forces to yours in a joint operation to protect these lands.
She looked up at him, amazed.
It was sent by Taravangian, king of Yakaved and Karbranth.
Taravangian? Dalinar hadn't expected him to reply so quickly. He was said to be a kindly, if somewhat simple, man. Perfect for ruling a small city-state with the help of a governing council. His elevation to king of Yakaved was widely seen as an act of spite from the former king, who hadn't wanted to give the throne to any of his rivals' houses. The words still warmed Dalinar. Someone had listened. Someone was willing to join him. Bless that man. Bless him. If Dalinar failed everywhere else, at least he would have King Taravangian at his side.
13. Chaperone. I ask only that you read or listen to these words. From Oathbringer. Preface. Shallan breathed out Stormlight and stepped through it, feeling it envelop her, transform her. She'd been moved upon request to Sabariel's section of Urethiru, in part because he'd promised her a room with a balcony, fresh air, and a view of the mountain peaks. If she couldn't be completely free of this building's shadowed depths, then at least she could have a home on the borders. She pulled at her hair, pleased to see it had turned black. She had become Vale, a disguise she'd been working on for some time. Shallan held up hands that were calloused and worked. even the safe hand. Not that Vale was unfeminine. She kept her nails filed and liked to dress nicely, keep her hair brushed. She simply didn't have time for frivolities. A good sturdy coat and trousers suited Vale better than a flowing hava, and she had no time for an extended sleeve covering her safe hand. She'd wear a glove, thank you very much. At the moment, she was dressed in her nightgown. She'd change later, once she was ready to sneak out into Eurythiru's halls. She needed some practice first. Though she felt bad about the use of Stormlight when everyone else was scrimping, Dalinar had told her to train with her powers. She strode through her chamber, adopting Vale's gait. Confident and sturdy, never prim. You couldn't balance a book on Vale's head as she walked, but she'd happily balance one on your face after she knocked you unconscious. She circled the room several times, crossing the patch of evening light from the window. Her room was ornamented by bright circular patterns of strata on the walls. The stone was smooth to the touch, and a knife couldn't scratch it. There wasn't much furniture, though Shallan was hopeful that the latest scavenging expeditions to the war camps would return with something she could appropriate from Sabariel. For now, she did what she could with some blankets, a single stool, and, blessedly, a hand mirror. She'd hung it on the wall, tied to a stone knob that she assumed was for hanging pictures. She checked her face in the mirror. She wanted to get to the point where she could become Vale at a moment's notice, without needing to review sketches. She prodded at her features, but of course, as the more angular nose and pronounced forehead were a result of light weaving, she couldn't feel them. When she frowned, Vale's face mimicked the motion perfectly. "Something to drink, please," she said. "No, rougher. Drink. Now. Too strong?" Pattern said. "The voice becomes a good lie." "Thank you. I've been working on sounds." Vale's voice was deeper than Shallan's. Rougher. She started to wonder how far could she go in changing how things sounded. For now, she wasn't sure she'd gotten the lips right in the illusion. She sauntered over to her art supplies and flipped open her sketchbook, looking for renditions of Vale she'd drawn instead of going to dinner with Sabariel and Palona. The first page of the sketchbook was of the corridor with the twisting strata she'd passed through the other day. Lines of madness curling toward darkness. She flipped to the next, a picture of one of the tower's budding markets. Thousands of merchants, washwomen, prostitutes, innkeepers, and craftsmen of all varieties were setting up in Eurythiru. Shallan knew well how many. She'd been the one to bring them all through the Oath Gate. In her sketch, the black upper reaches of the large market cavern loomed over tiny figures scurrying between tents, holding fragile lights. The next was another tunnel into darkness, and the next, then a room where the strata coiled about one another in a mesmerizing manner. She hadn't realized she'd done so many. She flipped 20 pages before she found her sketches of Vale. Yes, the lips were right. The build was wrong, however. Vale had a lean strength, and that wasn't coming through in the nightgown. It looked too much like Shallan's figure beneath. Someone knocked on the wooden plate hung outside her rooms. She had just a cloth draping the doorway right now. Many of the tower's doors had warped over the years. Hers had been ripped out, and she was still waiting on a replacement. The one knocking would be Palona, who had once again noticed that Shallan had skipped dinner. Shallan sucked in a breath, destroying the image of Vale, recovering some of the stormlight from her light weaving. "Come," she said. Honestly, it didn't seem to matter to Palona that Shallan was a storming knight radiant now. She'd still mother her all the... Adolin stepped in, carrying a large plate of food in one hand, some books under the other arm. He saw her and stumbled, nearly dropping it all. Shallan froze, then yelped and tucked her bare safe hand behind her back. Adolin didn't even have the decency to blush at finding her practically naked. He balanced the food in his hand, recovering from his stumble, and then grinned. "Out!" Shallan said, waving her free hand at him. "Out, out, out!" He backed away awkwardly, threw the draped cloth over the doorway. "Stormfather." Shallan's blush was probably so bright they could have used her as a signal to send the army to war. She pulled on a glove, then wrapped that in a safe pouch, then threw on the blue dress she had draped over the back of her chair and did up the sleeve. She didn't have the presence of mind to pull on her bodice vest first. Not that she really needed one anyway. She kicked it under a blanket instead. "In my defense," Adolin said from outside, "you did invite me in." "I thought you were Polona," Shallan said, doing up the buttons on the side of her dress, which proved difficult, with three layers covering her safe hand. "You know, you could check to see who is at your door." "Don't make this my fault," Shallan said. "You're the one slipping into young ladies' bedrooms practically unannounced." "I knocked." The knock was feminine. "It was Shallan." "Did you knock with one hand or two?" "I'm carrying a storming platter of food. For you, by the way. Of course the knock was one-handed. And seriously, who knocks with two?"
"It was quite feminine, then. I'd have thought that imitating a woman to catch a glimpse of a young lady in her undergarments was beneath you, Adolin Cullen."
"Oh, for damnation's sake, Shallan. Can I come in now? And just so we're clear, I'm a man, and you're betrothed. My name is Adolin Cullen. I was born under the sign of the Nine, I have a birthmark on the back of my left thigh, and I had crab curry for breakfast. Anything else you need to know?"
She poked her head out, pulling the cloth tight around her neck.
"Back of your left thigh, eh? What's a girl got to do to sneak a glimpse of that?"
"Knock like a man, apparently."
She gave him a grin.
"Just a sec. This dress is being a pain."
She ducked back into the room.
"Yes, yes, take your time. I'm not standing out here holding a heavy platter of food, smelling it after having skipped dinner so I could dine with you."
"It's good for you," Shallan said. "Builds strength or something. Isn't that the sort of thing you do? Strangle rocks, stand on your head, throw boulders around?"
"Yes, I have quite my share of murdered rocks stuffed under my bed."
Shallan grabbed her dress with her teeth at the neck to pull it tight, helping with the buttons. "Maybe."
"What is it with women and their undergarments, anyway?" Adolin said, the platter clinking as some of the plates slid against one another. "I mean, that shift covers basically the same parts as a formal dress."
"It's the decency of it," Shallan said around a mouthful of fabric. "Besides, certain things have a tendency to poke out through a shift."
"Still seems arbitrary to me."
"Oh, and men aren't arbitrary about clothing? A uniform is basically the same as any other coat, right? Besides, aren't you the one who spends his afternoons searching through fashion folios?"
He chuckled and started a reply, but Shallan, finally dressed, swept back the sheet on her doorway. Adolin stood up from leaning against the wall of the corridor and took her in. Frazzled hair, dress that she had missed two buttons on, cheeks flushed. Then he grinned a dopey grin.
Ash's eyes. He actually thought she was pretty. This wonderful, princely man actually liked being with her.
She'd traveled to the ancient city of the Knights Radiant. But compared to Adolin's affection, all the sights of Urethiru were dun spheres. He liked her. And he brought her food. "Do not find a way to screw this up," Shallan thought to herself, as she took the books from under his arm. She stepped aside, letting him enter and set the platter on the floor.
"Polona said you hadn't eaten," he said. "And then she found out I'd skipped dinner,
So she sent you with a lot, Shallan said, inspecting the platter piled high with dishes, flatbreads, and shell food. Yeah, Adolin said, standing and scratching at his head. I think it's a Herdazian thing. Shallan hadn't realized how hungry she was. She'd been intending to get something at one of the taverns later tonight while prowling about wearing Vale's face. Those taverns had set up in the main market, despite Navani's attempts to send them elsewhere, and Sabariel's merchants had quite the stock to sell. Now that this was all before her, well, she didn't worry much about decorum as she settled down on the ground and started to spoon herself up a thin, watery curry with vegetables. Adolin remained standing. He did look sharp in that blue uniform, though admittedly she'd never really seen him in anything else. Birthmark on the thigh, eh? You'll have to sit on the ground, Shallan said. No chairs yet.
I just realized, he said. This is your bedroom.
And my drawing room, and my sitting room, and my dining room, and my Adolin's as obvious things room. It's quite versatile, this room. Singular. Of mine. Why?
I'm just wondering if it's proper, he said.
Then actually blushed, which was adorable.
For us to be in here alone.
Now you're worried about propriety?
Well, I did recently get lectured about it.
That wasn't a lecture, Shallan said, taking a bite of food. The succulent tastes overwhelmed her mouth, bringing on that delightful sharp pain and mixing of flavor that you only got from the first bite of something sweet. She closed her eyes and smiled, savoring it.
So, not a lecture? Adolin said. Was there to be more to that quip?
Sorry, she said, opening her eyes. It wasn't a lecture. It was a creative application of my tongue to keep you distracted. Looking at his lips, she could think of some other creative applications for her tongue.
Right. She took a deep breath.
It would be inappropriate, Shallan said, if we were alone. Fortunately, we are not.
Your ego doesn't count as a separate individual, Shallan.
Ha, wait. You think I have an ego?
It just sounded good. I don't mean...
Not that. Why are you grinning? Sorry, Shallan said, making two fists before herself and shivering in glee. She'd spent so long feeling timid. It was so satisfying to hear a reference to her confidence. It was working. Yasna's teaching about practicing and acting like she was in control. It was working. Well, except for that whole part about having to admit to herself that she'd killed her mother. As soon as she thought of it, she instinctively tried to shove the memory away, but it wouldn't budge. She'd spoken it to Pattern as a truth, which were the odd ideals of the Lightweavers. It was stuck in her mind, and every time she thought about it, the gaping wound flared up with pain again. Shallan had killed her mother. Her father had covered it up, pretended he'd murdered his wife, and the event had destroyed his life, driving him to anger and destruction, until eventually Shallan had killed him, too.
Shallan? Adolin asked. Are you well?
No. Sure, fine. Anyway, we aren't alone. Pattern, come here, please. She held out her hand, palm up. He reluctantly moved down from the wall where he'd been watching. As always, he made a ripple in whatever he crossed, be it cloth or stone, like there was something under the surface. His complex, fluctuating pattern of lines was always changing, melding, vaguely circular, but with surprising tangents. He crossed up her dress and onto her hand, then split out from beneath her skin and rose into the air, expanding fully into three dimensions. He hovered there, a black, eye-bending network of shifting lines,
some patterns shrinking while others expanded, rippling across his surface like a field of moving grass. She would not hate him. She could hate the sword she'd used to kill her mother, but not him. She managed to push aside the pain for now, not forgetting it, but hopefully not letting it spoil her time with Adolin. "Prince Adolin," Shallan said, "I believe you've heard my friend's voice before. Let me introduce you formally. This is Pattern." Adolin knelt, reverent, and stared at the mesmerizing geometries. Shallan didn't blame him. She'd lost herself more than once in that network of lines and shapes that almost seemed to repeat, but never quite did. "Your Spren," Adolin said. "A Shallan Spren." Pattern sniffed in annoyance at that. "He's called a cryptic," she said. "Every order of Radiant bonds a different variety of Spren, and that bond lets me do what I do." "Craft illusions," Adolin said softly. "Like that one with the map the other day." Shallan smiled, and, realizing she had just a smidge of stormlight left from her illusion earlier, was unable to resist showing off. She raised her sleeved safe hand and breathed out, sending a shimmering patch of stormlight above the blue cloth. It formed into a small image of Adolin from her sketches of him in his shard plate. This one remained frozen, shard blade on his shoulder, faceplate up, like a little doll. "This is an incredible talent, Shallan," Adolin said, poking at the version of himself, which fuzzed, offering no resistance. He paused, then poked at Pattern, who shied back. "Why do you insist on hiding this, pretending that you're a different order than you are?" "Well," she said, thinking fast, and closing her hand, dismissing the image of Adolin. "I just think it might give us an edge. Sometimes secrets are important." Adolin nodded slowly. "Yeah. Yeah, they are." "Anyway," Shallan said, "Pattern, you're to be our chaperone tonight."
"What?" Pattern said with a hum. "Is a chaperone?"
"That is someone who watches two young people when they are together to make certain they don't do anything inappropriate."
"Inappropriate?" Pattern said. "Such as dividing by zero?"
"What?" Shallan asked, looking to Adolin, who shrugged. "Look, just keep an eye on us. It will be all right." Pattern hummed, melting down into his two-dimensional form and taking up residence on the side of a bowl. He seemed content there, like a Kremlin snuggled into its crack. Unable to wait any longer, Shallan dug into her meal. Adolin settled down across from her and attacked his own food. For a time, Shallan ignored her pain and savored the moment. Good food, good company, the setting sun casting ruby and topaz light across the mountains and into the room. She felt like drawing this scene, but knew it was the type of moment she couldn't capture on a page. It wasn't about content or composition, but the pleasure of living. The trick to happiness wasn't in freezing every momentary pleasure and clinging to each one, but in ensuring one's life would produce many future moments to anticipate. Adolin, after finishing an entire plate of Stranahaspers steamed in the shell, picked out a few chunks of pork from a creamy red curry, then put them on a plate and handed them in her direction. "Want to try a bite?" Shallan made a gagging noise. "Come on," he said, wagging the plate. "It's delicious."
"It would burn my lips off, Adolin Colin," Shallan said. "Don't think I didn't notice you picking the absolute spiciest concoction Polona sent. Men's food is dreadful. How can you taste anything beneath all that spice?"
"Keeps it from being bland," Adolin said, stabbing one of the chunks and popping it in his mouth. "There's nobody here but us. You can try it." She eyed it, remembering the times as a child when she'd sneaked tastes of men's food, though not this specific dish. Pattern buzzed. Is this the inappropriate thing I'm supposed to stop you from doing? No, Shallan said, and Pattern settled back down. Perhaps a chaperone, she thought, who believes basically everything I tell him isn't going to be the most effective. Still, with a sigh, she grabbed a chunk of the pork and some flatbread. She had left Yakoved hunting new experiences, after all. She tried a bite, and was given immediate reason to regret her decisions in life. Eyes brimming with tears, she scrambled for the cup of water Adolin, insufferably, had picked up to hand toward her. She gulped that down, though it didn't seem to do anything. She followed it by wiping her tongue with a napkin, in the most feminine way possible, of course. I hate you, she said, drinking his water next. Adolin chuckled. Oh, Pattern said suddenly, bursting up from the bowl to hover in the air. You were talking about mating. I'm to make sure you don't accidentally mate, as mating is forbidden by human society until you have first performed appropriate rituals. Yes, yes. Dictates of custom require following certain patterns before you copulate. I've been studying this. Oh, Stormfather, Shallan said, covering her eyes with her free hand. A few shame-spren even peeked in for a glimpse before vanishing. Twice in 1 week. Very well, you two, Pattern said. No mating. No mating! He hummed to himself as if pleased, then sank down onto a plate. Well, that was humiliating, Shallan said. Can we maybe talk about those books you brought? Or ancient Vorin theology? Or strategies for counting grains of sand? Anything other than what just happened, please? Adolin chuckled, then reached for a slim notebook that was on top of the pile. May Aladar sent teams to question Vedekar Peril's family and friends. They discovered where he was before he died, who last saw him, and wrote down anything suspicious. I thought we could read the report. And the rest of the books? You seemed lost when Father asked you about Makabaki politics, Adolin said, pouring some wine, merely a soft yellow. So I asked around, and it seems that some of the Ardents hauled their entire libraries out here. I was able to get a servant to locate you a few books I'd enjoyed on the Makabaki. Books? Shallan said. You? I don't spend all my time hitting people with swords, Shallan, Adolin said. Yasna and Aunt Navani made very certain that my youth was filled with interminable periods spent listening to Ardents lecture me on politics and trade. Some of it stuck in my brain, against my natural inclinations. Those three books are the best of the ones I remember having read to me, though the last one is an updated version. I thought it might help. That's thoughtful, she said. Really, Adolin. Thank you. I figured, you know, if we're going to move forward with the betrothal. Why wouldn't we? Shallan said, suddenly panicked. I don't know. You're a radiant, Shallan. Some kind of half-divine being from mythology. And all along I was thinking we were giving you a favorable match. He stood up and started pacing. Damnation. I didn't mean to say it like that. I'm sorry. I keep worrying that I'm going to screw this up somehow. You worry you're going to screw it up? Shallan said, feeling a warmth inside that wasn't completely due to the wine. I'm not good with relationships, Shallan. Is there anyone who actually is? I mean, is there really someone out there who looks at relationships and thinks, you know what, I've got this? Personally, I rather think we're all collectively idiots about it. It's worse for me. Adolin, dear, the last man I had a romantic interest in was not only an Ardent, forbidden to court me in the first place,
but also turned out to be an assassin who was merely trying to obtain my favor so he could get close to Jasnah. I think you overestimate everyone else's capability in this regard. He stopped pacing.
An assassin?
Seriously, Shallan said. He almost killed me with a loaf of poisoned bread.
Wow. I have to hear this story.
Fortunately, I just told it to you. His name was Capsal, and he was so incredibly sweet to me that I can almost forgive him for trying to kill me.
Adolin grinned. Well, it's nice to hear that I don't have a high bar to jump. All I have to do is not poison you.
Though you shouldn't be telling me about past lovers. You'll make me jealous. Please, Shallan said, dipping her bread in some leftover sweet curry. Her tongue still hadn't recovered. You've courted like half the war camps.
It's not that bad.
Isn't it? From what I hear, I'd have to go to Herdaz to find an eligible woman you haven't pursued. She held out her hand to him to help her to her feet.
Are you mocking my failings?
No, I'm lauding them, she said, standing up beside him. You see, Adolin, dear, if you hadn't wrecked all those other relationships, you wouldn't be here, with me. She pulled close. And so, in reality, you're the greatest at relationships there ever was. You ruined only the wrong ones, you see. He leaned down. His breath smelled of spices. His uniform of the crisp, clean starch Dalinar required. His lips touched hers, and her heart fluttered. So warm.
No mating!
She started, pulling out of the kiss-defined pattern hovering beside them, pulsing quickly through shapes. Adolin bellowed a laugh, and Shallan couldn't help joining in at the ridiculousness of it. She stepped back from him, but kept hold on his hand. Neither of us is going to mess this up, she said to him, squeezing his hand. Despite what might at times seem like our best efforts otherwise.
Promise? He asked.
I promise. Let's look at this notebook of yours and see what it says about our murderer.
14. Squires can't capture. In this record I hold nothing back. I will try not to shy away from difficult topics or paint myself in a dishonestly heroic light. From Oathbringer, Preface. Kaladin crept through the rains, sidling in a wet uniform across the rocks until he was able to peek through the trees at the Voidbringers. Monstrous terrors from the mythological past, enemies of all that was right and good, destroyers who had laid waste to civilization countless times. They were playing cards. What in damnation's depths? Kaladin thought. The Voidbringers had posted a single guard, but the creature had simply been sitting on a tree stump, easy to avoid. A decoy, Kaladin had assumed, figuring he would find the true guard watching from the heights of the trees. If there was a hidden guard, though, Kaladin had missed spotting them, and they'd missed Kaladin in equal measure. The dim light served him well, as he was able to settle between some bushes right at the edge of the Voidbringer camp. Between trees they had stretched tarps, which leaked horribly. In one place they'd made a proper tent, fully enclosed with walls, and he couldn't see what was inside. There wasn't enough shelter, so many sat out in the rain. Kaladin spent a torturous few minutes expecting to be spotted. All they had to do was notice that these bushes had drawn in their leaves at his touch. Nobody looked, fortunately. The leaves timidly peeked back out, obscuring him. Syl landed on his arm, hands on her hips as she surveyed the Voidbringers. One of them had a set of wooden Hardassian cards, and he sat at the edge of the camp, directly before Kaladin, using a flat surface of stone as a table. A female sat opposite him. They looked different from what he expected. For one thing, their skin was a different shade. Many parchmen here in Alethkar had marbled white and red skin, rather than the deep red on black, like Rulaine from Bridge 4. They didn't wear war form, though neither did they wear some terrible, powerful form. Though they were squat and bulky, their only carapace ran along the sides of their forearms and jutted out at their temples, leaving them with full heads of hair. They still wore their simple slave smocks, tied at the waists with strings. No red eyes. Did that change, perhaps, like his own eyes? The male, distinguished by a dark red beard, the hairs each unnaturally thick, finally placed a card in the rock next to several others.
"Can you do that?" the female asked. "I think so. You said squires can't capture, unless another card of mine is touching yours," the male said.
He scratched at his beard.
"I think..."
Kaladin felt cold, like the rainwater was seeping in through his skin, penetrating all the way to his blood and washing through him. They spoke like a Lethe, not a hint of an accent. With his eyes closed, he wouldn't have been able to tell these voices from those of common dark-eyed villagers from Hearthstone, save for the fact that the female had a deeper voice than most human women.
"So," the female said, "you're saying you don't know how to play the game after all?"
The male began gathering up the cards.
"I should know, Ken. How many times did I watch them play? Standing there with my tray of drinks? I should be an expert at this, shouldn't I?" "Apparently not."
The female stood and walked over to another group who were trying to build a fire under a tarp without much success. It took a special kind of luck to be able to get flames going outside during the weeping. Kaladin, like most in the military, had learned to live with a constant dampness. They had the stolen sacks of grain. Kaladin could see them piled underneath one of the tarps. The grain had swollen, splitting several of the sacks. Several were eating soggy handfuls since they had no bowls. Kaladin wished he didn't immediately taste the mushy, awful stuff in his own mouth. He'd been given unspiced, boiled talu on many occasions. Often he'd considered it a blessing. The male who'd been speaking continued to sit on his rock, holding up a wooden card. They were a lacquered set, durable. Kaladin had occasionally seen their like in the military. Men would save for months to get a set like this that wouldn't warp in the rain. The parchman looked so forlorn, staring down at his card, shoulders slumped.
"This is wrong," Kaladin whispered to Syl. "We've been so wrong."
Where were the destroyers? What had happened to the beasts with the red eyes that had tried to crush Dalinar's army? The terrible, haunting figures that Bridge Four had described to him?
"We thought we understood what was going to happen," Kaladin thought. "I was so sure."
"Alarm!" a sudden shrill voice called. "Alarm, you fools!"
Something zipped through the air, a glowing yellow ribbon, a streak of light in the dim afternoon shade.
"He's there!" the shrill voice said. "You're being watched! Beneath those shrubs!"
Kaladin burst up through the underbrush, ready to suck in stormlight and be away. Though fewer towns had any now, as it was running out again, he had a little left. The parchman seized cudgels made from branches or the handles of brooms. They bunched together and held the sticks like frightened villagers. No stance, no control. Kaladin hesitated.
"I could take them all in a fight even without stormlight."
He'd seen men hold weapons like that many times before. Most recently, he'd seen it inside the chasms when training the bridgemen. These were no warriors. Syl flitted up to him, prepared to become a blade.
"No,"
Kaladin whispered to her. Then he held his hands to the sides, speaking more loudly.
"I surrender."
15. Brightness Radiant. I will express only direct, even brutal truth. You must know what I have done, and what those actions cost me. From Oathbringer, Preface. Brightlord Peril's body was found in the same area as Sadius's, Shallan said, pacing back and forth in her room as she flipped through pages of the report. "That can't be a coincidence. This tower is far too big. So we know where the murderer is prowling."
"Yeah, I suppose,"
Adolin said. He lounged with his back against the wall, coat unbuttoned, while tossing a small leather ball filled with dried grain into the air and catching it again. I just think the murders could have been done by two different people. Same exact method of murder, Shallan said. Body positioned the same way. Nothing else connecting them, Adolin said. Sadeus was slime, widely hated, and usually accompanied by guards. Peril was quiet, well-liked, and known for his administrative prowess. He was less a soldier than a manager. The sun had fully set by now, and they'd set out spheres on the floor for light. The remnants of their meal had been carted away by a servant, and Pattern hummed happily on the wall near Adolin's head. Adolin glanced at him occasionally, looking uncomfortable, which she fully understood. She'd grown used to Pattern, but his lines were strange. Wait until Adolin sees a cryptic in Shadesmar form, she thought, with a full body but twisting shapes for his head. Adolin tossed the little stitched ball into the air and caught it with his right hand, the one that Renarin amazingly had healed. She wasn't the only one practicing with her powers. She was especially glad someone else had a shard blade now. When the high storms returned, and they began working the Oath Gate in earnest, she'd have help. These reports, Shallan said, tapping the notebook against her hand, are both informative and useless. Nothing connects Peril and Sadeus, save their both being light eyes, that and the part of the tower they were in. Perhaps mere opportunity drove the killer's choice of victims. You're saying someone happened to kill a high prince? Adolin said. By accident? Like a back-alley murder outside a pub? Maybe. Brightness Aladar suggests in here that your father lay down some rules on people moving alone through empty parts of the tower. I still think there might be two murderers, Adolin said. You know, like someone saw Sadeus dead and figured they could get away with killing someone else, blaming it on the first fellow. Oh, Adolin, Shallan thought. He'd arrived at a theory he liked, and now wouldn't let it go. It was a common mistake, warned of in her scientific books. Adolin did have one point. A high prince being murdered was unlikely to be random chance. There were no signs of Sadeus's shard blade, Oathbringer, being used by anyone. Not even a rumor of it. Maybe the second death is a kind of decoy, Shallan thought, riffling through the report again. An attempt to make it seem like random attacks? No, that was too convoluted, and she had no more evidence for it than Adolin had for his theory. That did leave her thinking. Maybe everyone was paying attention to these two deaths because they'd happened to important light eyes. Could there be other deaths they hadn't noticed because they'd happened to less prominent individuals? If a beggar had been found in Adolin's proverbial back alley behind a pub, would anyone have remarked upon it, even if he'd been stabbed through the eye? I need to get out there among them and see what I can find. She opened her mouth to tell him she should probably turn in, but he was already standing, stretching. I think we've done what we can with that, he said, nodding toward the report. At least for tonight. Yeah, Shallan said, feigning a yawn. Probably. So, Adolin said, then took a deep breath. There's something else. Shallan frowned. Something else? Why did he suddenly look like he was preparing to do something difficult? He's going to break off our betrothal, a part of her mind thought, though she pounced on that emotion and shoved it back behind the curtains where it belonged.
Okay. This isn't easy, Adolin said. I don't want to offend Shallan, but you know how I had you eat that man's food?
Yes. If my tongue is particularly spicy in the coming days, I blame you.
Shallan, there's something similar that we need to talk about. Something about you we can't just ignore.
I killed my parents. I stabbed my mother through the chest and I strangled my father while singing to him.
You, Adeline said, have a shard blade.
I didn't want to kill her. I had to. I had to.
Adeline grabbed her by the shoulders and she started focusing on him. He was grinning.
You have a shard blade, Shallan! A new one! That's incredible! I dreamed for years of earning my blade. So many men spend their lives with that very dream and never see it fulfilled. And here you have one.
And that's a good thing, right? She said, held in his grip with arms pulled tight against her body.
Of course it is, Adeline said, letting go of her. But, I mean, you're a woman.
Was it the makeup that tipped you off? Or the dress? Oh, it was the breasts, wasn't it? Always giving us away.
Shallan, this is serious.
I know, she said, calming her nerves.
Yes. Pattern can become a shard blade, Adeline. I don't see what this has to do with anything. I can't give it away.
Stormfather, you want to teach me how to use it, don't you?
He grinned.
You said that Jasnah was a Radiant, too. Women, gaining shard blades. It's weird, but it's not like we can ignore it. What about plate? Do you have that hidden somewhere, too?
Not that I know of, she said. Her heart was beating quickly, her skin growing cold, her muscles tense. She fought against the sensation. I don't know where plate comes from.
I know it's not feminine, but who cares? You've got a sword. You should know how to use it. And custom can go to damnation. There, I said it.
He took a deep breath.
I mean, the bridge boy can have one, and he's dark-eyed. Well, he was. Anyway, it's not so different from that.
Thank you, Shallan thought. For ranking all women as something equivalent to peasants. But she held her tongue. This was obviously an important moment for Adeline, and he was trying to be broad-minded. But thinking of what she'd done pained her. Holding the weapon would be worse. So much worse. She wanted to hide, but she couldn't. This truth refused to budge from her mind. Could she explain?
So, you're right, but...
Great, Adeline said. Great. I brought the blade guards so we won't hurt each other. I stashed them back at the guard post. I'll go fetch them.
He was out the door a moment later. Shallan stood with her hand stretched toward him, objections dying on her lips. She curled her fingers up and brought her hand to her breast, her heart thundering within.
Pattern said. This is good. This needs to be done.
Shallan scrambled through the room to the small mirror she'd hung from the wall. She stared at herself, eyes wide, hair an utter mess. She'd started breathing in sharp, quick gasps.
I can't, she said. I can't be this person, Pattern. I can't just wield the sword. Some brilliant knight on a tower pretending she should be followed.
Pattern hummed softly a tone she'd come to recognize as confusion, the bewilderment of one species trying to comprehend the mind of another. Sweat trickled down Shallan's face, running beside her eye as she stared at herself. What did she expect to see? The thought of breaking down in front of Adeline heightened her tension. Her every muscle grew taut, and the corners of her vision started to darken. She could see only before herself, and she wanted to run, go somewhere.
Be away. No, no, just be someone else.
Hands shaking, she scrambled over and dug out her drawing pad. She ripped pages, flinging them out of the way to reach an empty one, then seized her charcoal pencil. Pattern moved over to her, a floating ball of shifting lines, buzzing in concern.
Shallan, please,
What is wrong?
I can hide, Shallan thought, drawing at a frenzied pace. Shallan can flee and leave someone in her place.
It's because you hate me, Pattern said softly. I can die, Shallan. I can go. They will send you another to bond.
A high-pitched whine started to rise in the room, one Shallan didn't immediately recognize as coming from the back of her own throat. Pattern's words were like knives to her side. No, please, just draw. Vale. Vale would be fine holding a sword. She didn't have Shallan's broken soul and hadn't killed her parents. She'd be able to do this. No. No, what would Adolin do if he returned and found a completely different woman in the room? He couldn't know of Vale. The lines she sketched, ragged and unrefined from the shaking pencil, quickly took the shape of her own face. But hair in a bun. A poised woman. Not as flighty as Shallan. Not as unintentionally silly. A woman who hadn't been sheltered. A woman hard enough, strong enough to wield this sword. A woman like Jasnah. Yes, Jasnah's subtle smile, composure, and self-confidence. Shallan outlined her own face with these ideals, creating a harder version of it. Could she be this woman? I have to be, Shallan thought, drawing in stormlight from her satchel, then breathing it out in a puff around her. She stood up as the change took hold. Her heartbeat slowed, and she wiped the sweat from her brow, then calmly undid her safe hand sleeve, tossed aside the foolish extra pouch she'd tied around her hand inside, then rolled the sleeve back to expose her still-gloved hand. Good enough. Adolin couldn't possibly expect her to put on sparring clothing. She pulled her hair back into a bun and fixed it in place with hair spikes from her satchel. When Adolin returned to the room a moment later, he found a poised, calm woman who wasn't quite Shallan Devar. Brightness Radiant is her name, she thought. She will go only by title. Adolin carried two long, thin pieces of metal that somehow could meld to the front of shard blades and make them less dangerous for use in sparring. Radiant inspected them with a critical eye, then held her hand to the side, summoning Pattern. The blade formed, a long, thin weapon nearly as tall as she was. Pattern, she said, can modulate his shape and will dull his edge to safe levels. I shan't need such a clunky device. Indeed, Pattern's edge rippled, dulling.
Storms, that's handy.
I'll still need one, though. Adolin summoned his own blade, a process that took him 10 heartbeats, during which he turned his head, looking at her. Shallan glanced down, realizing that she'd enhanced her bust in this guise. Not for him, of course. She'd just been making herself look more like Jasnah. Adolin's sword finally appeared, with a thicker blade than her own, sinuous along the sharp edge, with delicate crystalline ridges along the back. He put one of the guards on the sword's edge. Radiant put one foot forward, blade lifted high in two hands beside her head.
Hey, Adolin said. That's not bad.
Shallan did spend quite a lot of time drawing you all. Adolin nodded thoughtfully. He approached and reached toward her with a thumb and two fingers. She thought he was going to adjust her grip, but instead he pressed his fingers against her collarbone and shoved lightly. Radiant stumbled backward, almost tripping.
A stance, Adolin said, is about more than just looking great on the battlefield. It's about footing, center of balance, and control of the fight.
Noted. So how do I make it better?
I'm trying to decide. Everyone I've worked with before had been using a sword since their youth. I'm wondering how Zael would have changed my training if I'd never even picked up a weapon.
From what I've heard of him, Radiant said, it will depend on whether there are any convenient rooftops nearby to jump off.
That's how he trained with Plate, Adolin said. This is Blade. Should I teach you dueling? Or should I teach you how to fight in an army?
I shall settle, Radiant said, for knowing how to avoid cutting off any of my own appendages, Brightlord Colin.
Brightlord Colin?
Too formal. Right. That was how Radiant would act, of course. But she could allow herself some familiarity. Yasna had done that. I was merely, Radiant said, attempting to show the respect due a master from his humble pupil.
Adolin chuckled. Please, we don't need that. But here, let's see what we can do about that stance.
Over the next hour, Adolin positioned her hands, her feet, and her arms a dozen times over. He picked a basic stance for her that she could eventually adapt into several of the formal stances, the ones like wind stance, which Adolin said wouldn't rely on strength or reach as much as mobility and skill. She wasn't certain why he'd bothered fetching the metal sparring sleeves, as the two of them didn't exchange any blows. Other than correcting her stance 10,000 times, he spoke about the art of the duel, how to treat your shard blade, how to think of an opponent, how to show respect to the institutions and traditions of the duel itself. Some of it was very practical. Shard blades were dangerous weapons, which explained the demonstrations on how to hold hers, how to walk with it, how to take care not to slice people or things while casually turning. Other parts of his monologue were more mystical.
The blade is part of you, Adolin said. The blade is more than your tool. It is your life. Respect it. It will not fail you. If you are bested, it is because you failed the sword.
Radiant stood in what felt like a very stiff pose, blade held before herself in two hands. She'd only scraped pattern on the ceiling two or three times. Fortunately, most of the rooms in Urethiru had high ceilings. Adolin gestured for her to perform a simple strike, as they'd been practicing. Radiant raised both arms, tilting the sword, then took a step forward while bringing it down. The entire angle of movement couldn't have been more than 90 degrees. Barely a strike at all. Adolin smiled.
You're catching it. A few thousand more of those and it will start to feel natural. We'll have to work on your breathing, though.
My breathing? He nodded absently. Adolin, Radiant said, I assure you I have been breathing without fail my entire life.
Yeah, he said. That's why you're going to have to unlearn it.
How I stand, how I think, how I breathe. I have trouble distinguishing what is actually relevant and what is part of the subculture and superstition of swordsmen.
It's all relevant, Adolin said.
Eating chicken before a match?
Adolin grinned.
Well, maybe some things are personal quirks.
But the swords are part of us.
I know mine is part of me, Radiant said, resting the blade at her side and setting her gloved safe hand on it. I've bonded it. I suspect this is the origin of the tradition among shard-bearers.
So academic, Adolin said, shaking his head. You need to feel this, Shallan. Live it.
That would not have been a difficult task for Shallan. Radiant, however, preferred not to feel things she hadn't considered in depth beforehand. Have you considered, she said, that your shard blade was once a living spren, wielded by one of the knights Radiant? Doesn't that change how you look at it? Adolin glanced toward his blade, which he'd left summoned, strapped with the sheath, and set across her blankets.
I've always kind of known. Not that it was alive. That's silly. Swords aren't alive. I mean, I've always known there was something special about them. It's part of being a duelist, I think. We all know it.
She let the matter drop. Swordsmen, from what she'd seen, were superstitious. as were sailors, as were, well, basically everyone but scholars like Radiant and Jasnah. It was curious to her how much of Adolin's rhetoric about blades and dueling reminded her of religion. How strange that these Alethi often treated their actual religion so flippantly. In Yakeved, Shallan had spent hours painting lengthy passages from the arguments. You'd speak the words out loud over and over, committing them to memory while kneeling or bowing, before finally burning the paper. The Alethi instead preferred to let the Ardents deal with the Almighty, like he was some annoying parlor guest who could be safely distracted by servants offering a particularly tasty tea. Adolin let her do some more strikes, perhaps sensing that she was growing tired of having her stance constantly adjusted. As she was swinging, he grabbed his own blade and fell in beside her, modeling the stance and the strikes. After a short time of that, she dismissed her blade, then picked up her sketchbook. She quickly flipped past the drawing of Radiant and started to sketch Adolin in his stance. She was forced to let some of Radiant bleed away. "No, stand there," Shallan said, pointing at Adolin with her charcoal. "Yes, like that." She sketched out the stance, then nodded. "Now strike, and hold the last position." He did so. By now he'd removed his jacket, standing in only shirt and trousers. She did like how that tight shirt fit him. Even Radiant would admire that. She wasn't dead, just pragmatic. She looked over the two sketches, then resummoned Pattern and fell into position. "Hey, nice," Adolin said, as Radiant performed the next few strikes. "Yeah, you've got it." He again fell in beside her. The simple attack he'd taught her was obviously a poor test of his skills, but he executed it with precision nonetheless, then grinned and started talking about the first few lessons he'd had with Zael long ago. His blue eyes were alight, and Shallan loved seeing that glow from him, almost like stormlight. She knew that passion. She'd felt what it was to be alive with interest, to be consumed by something so fully that you lost yourself in the wonder of it. For her it was art, but watching him, she thought that the two of them weren't so different. Sharing these moments with him and drinking of his excitement felt special, intimate, even more so than their closeness had been earlier in the evening. She let herself be Shallan in some of the moments, but whenever the pain of holding the sword started to spike, whenever she really thought about what she was doing, she was able to become Radiant and avoid it. She was genuinely reluctant to see the time end, so she let it stretch into the late evening, well past when she should have called a halt. At long last, Shallan bade a tired, sweaty farewell to Adolin, and watched him trot down the strata-lined hallway outside, a spring to his step, a lamp in his hand, blade guards held on his shoulder. Shallan would have to wait another night to visit taverns and hunt for answers. She trailed back into her room, strangely contented for all that the world might be in the middle of ending. That night she slept, for once, in peace.
16. Wrapped three times. For in this comes the lesson. From Oathbringer, Preface. A legend rested on the stone slab before Dalinar, a weapon pulled from the ancient mists of time, and said to have been forged during the shadowed days by the hand of God himself. The blade of the assassin in white, claimed by Caladan Stormblessed during their clash above the storm. Upon cursory inspection, it was indistinguishable from an ordinary shard blade. Elegant, relatively small in that it was barely 5 feet long, it was thin and curved like a tusk. It had patterns only at the base of the blade, near the hilt. He'd lit it with four diamond bromes, placed at the corners of the altar-like stone slab. This small room had no strata or paintings on the walls, so the stormlight lit only him and that alien blade. It did have one oddity. There was no gemstone. Gemstones were what allowed men to bond to shard blades. Often affixed at the pommel, though occasionally at the spot where hilt met blade, the gem would flash when you first touched it, initiating the process. Keep the blade with you for a week, and the blade became yours, dismissible and returnable in time with your heartbeat. This blade didn't have one. Dalinar hesitantly reached out and rested his fingers on its silvery length. It was warm to the touch, like something alive. It doesn't scream when I touch it, he noted.
The knights, the Stormfather said in his head, broke their oaths. They abandoned everything they'd sworn, and in so doing killed their Spren. Other blades are the corpses of those Spren, which is why they scream at your touch. This weapon, instead, was made directly from Honor's soul, then given to the heralds. It is also the mark of an oath, but a different type, and does not have the mind to scream on its own.
And Shardplate? Dalinar asked.
Related, but different, the Stormfather rumbled. You haven't spoken the oaths required to know more.
You cannot break oaths, Dalinar said, fingers still resting on the honor blade. Right?
I cannot.
What of the thing we fight, Odium? The origin of the Voidbringers and their Spren. Can he break oaths?
No, the Stormfather said. He is far greater than I, but the power of ancient Adonalsium permeates him and controls him. Odium is a force like pressure, gravitation, or the movement of time. These things cannot break their own rules, nor can he.
Dalinar tapped the honor blade, a fragment of honor's own soul, crystallized into metallic form. In a way, the death of their god gave him hope. For if honor had fallen, surely Odium could as well. In visions, honor had left Dalinar with a task.
Vex Odium. Convince him that he can lose and appoint a champion. He will take that chance instead of risking defeat again, as he has suffered so often. This is the best advice I can give you.
I've seen that the enemy is preparing a champion, Dalinar said. A dark creature with red eyes and nine shadows. Will Honor's suggestion work? Can I make Odium agree to a decisive contest between me and that champion?
Of course Honor's suggestion would work, the Stormfather said. He spoke it.
I mean, Dalinar said, why would it work? Why would this Odium ever agree to a contest of champions? It seems too momentous a matter to risk on something so small and inferior as the prowess and will of men.
Your enemy is not a man like you, the Stormfather replied, voice rumbling, thoughtful, even frightened. He does not age. He feels. He is angry. But this does not change, and his rage does not cool. Epochs can pass, and he will remain the same. To fight directly might coax out forces that could hurt him, as he has been hurt before. Those scars do not heal. To pick a champion, then lose, will only cost him time. He has that in plenitude. He still will not agree easily, but it is possible he will agree, if presented with the option in the right moment, the right way. Then he will be bound. And we win time, the Stormfather said, which, though dross to him, is the most valuable thing a man can have.
Dalinar slipped the honor blade off the slab. At the side of the room, a shaft cut into the ground. 2 feet wide, it was one of many strange holes, corridors, and hidden corners they'd found in the Tower City. This one was probably part of a sewage system. Judging by the rust on the edges of the hole, there had once been a metal pipe here connecting the stone hole in the floor to one in the ceiling. One of Navani's primary concerns was figuring out how all this worked. For now, they'd gotten by using wooden frames to turn certain large communal rooms with ancient baths into privies. Once they had more stormlight, their soulcasters could deal with the waste as they'd done in the war camps. Navani found the system inelegant. Communal privies with sometimes long lines made for an inefficient city, and she claimed that these tubes indicated a widespread piping and sanitation system. It was exactly the sort of large-scale civic project that engaged her. He'd never known anyone to get as excited by sewage as Navani Colin. For now, this tube was empty. Dalinar knelt and lowered the sword into the hole, sliding it into a stone sheath he'd cut in the side. The upper lip of the hole shielded the protruding hilt from sight. You'd have to reach down and feel in the hole to find the honor blade. He stood up, then gathered his spheres and made his way out. He hated leaving it there, but he could think of nothing safer. His rooms didn't feel secure enough yet. He had no vault, and a crowd of guards would only draw attention. Beyond Kaladin, Navani, and the Stormfather himself, nobody even knew that Dalinar had this. If he masked his movements, there was virtually no chance of the blade being discovered in this vacant portion of the tower.
"What will you do with it?" the Stormfather asked as Dalinar entered the empty corridors. "It is a weapon beyond parallel, the gift of a god. With it you would be a windrunner, unoathed, and more. More that men do not understand and cannot. Like a herald, nearly." "All the more reason," Dalinar said, "to think very carefully before using it. Though I wouldn't mind if you kept an eye on it for me." The Stormfather actually laughed. "You think I can see all things? I kind of assumed, the map we made. I see what is left out in the storms, and that darkly. I am no god, Dalinar Colin. No more than your shadow on the wall is you."
Dalinar reached the steps downward, then wound around and around, holding a broom for light. If Captain Kaladin didn't return soon, the honor blade would provide another means of windrunning, a way to get to Thalen City or Aesir at speed, or to get Elikar's team to Kolinar. The Stormfather had also confirmed it could work oath gates, which might prove handy. Dalinar reached more inhabited sections of the tower, which bustled with movement. A chef's assistants hauling supplies from the storage dump right inside the tower gates, a couple of men painting lines on the floor to guide, families of soldiers in a particularly wide hallway, sitting on boxes along the wall and watching children roll wooden spheres down a slope into a room that had probably been another bath. Life. Such an odd place to make a home. Yet they'd transformed the barren, shattered plains into one. This tower wouldn't be so different, assuming they could keep farming operations going on the shattered plains, and assuming they had enough stormlight to keep those oath gates working. He was the odd man out, holding a sphere. Guards patrolled with lanterns, the cooks worked by lamp oil, but their stores were starting to run low. The women watching children and darning socks used only the light of a few windows along the wall here. Dalinar passed near his rooms. Today's guard, spearman from Bridge 13, waited outside. He waved for them to follow him.
"Is all well, Bright Lord?" one asked, catching up quickly.
He spoke with a slow drawl, a Koran accent, from near the Sunmaker Mountains in central Alethkar.
"Fine," Dalinar said tersely, trying to determine the time. How long had he spent speaking with the Stormfather?
"Good, good," the guard said,
spear held lightly to his shoulder. "Wouldn't want anything to have happened to you while you were out, alone, in the corridors, when you said nobody should be going about alone."
Delinar eyed the man. Clean-shaven, he was a little pale for an Alethi and had dark brown hair. Delinar vaguely thought the man had shown up among his guards several times during the last week or so. He liked to roll a sphere across his knuckles in what Delinar found to be a distracting way.
"Your name?" Delinar asked as they walked.
"Ryle," the man said. "Bridge 13. The soldier raised a hand and gave a precise salute, so careful it could have been given by one of Dalinar's finest officers, except he maintained the same lazy expression.
"Well, Sergeant Ryle, I was not alone," Dalinar said. "Where did you get this habit of questioning officers?"
"It isn't a habit if you only do it once, Bright Lord."
"And you've only ever done it once?"
"To you?"
"To anyone."
"Well," Ryle said, "those don't count, Bright Lord. I'm a new man, reborn in the bridge crews."
"Lovely. Well, Ryle, do you know what time it is? I have trouble telling in these storming corridors."
"You could use the clock device Brightness Navani sent you, sir," Ryle said. "I think that's what they're for, you know."
Dalinar affixed him with another glare.
"Wasn't questioning you, sir," Ryle said. "It wasn't a question. See,"
Dalinar finally turned and stalked back down the corridor to his rooms. Where was that package Navani had given him? He found it on an end table, and from inside it removed a leather bracer somewhat like what an archer would wear. It had two clock faces set into the top. One showed the time with three hands, even seconds, as if that mattered. The other was a storm clock, which could be set to wind down to the next projected high storm.
"How do they get it all so small?" he wondered, shaking the device.
Set into the leather, it also had a pain reel, a gemstone fabrial that would take pain from him if he pressed his hand on it. Navani had been working on various forms of pain-related fabrials for use by surgeons, and had mentioned using him as a test subject. He strapped the device to his forearm, right above his wrist. It felt conspicuous there, wrapping around the outside of his uniform sleeve, but it had been a gift. In any case, he had an hour until his next scheduled meeting. Time to work out some of his restless energy. He collected his two guards, then made his way down a level to one of the larger chambers near where he housed his soldiers. The room had black and gray strata on the walls and was filled with men training. They all wore Colin blue, even if just an armband. For now, both Light Eyes and Dark practiced in the same chamber, sparring in rings with padded cloth mats. As always, the sounds and smells of sparring warmed Dalinar. Sweeter than the scent of flatbread baking was that of oiled leather. More welcoming than the sound of flutes was that of practice swords rapping against one another. Wherever he was and whatever station he obtained, a place like this would always be home. He found the sword masters assembled at the back wall, seated on cushions and supervising their students. Save for one notable exception, they all had squared beards, shaved heads, and simple open-fronted robes that tied at the waist. Dalinar owned ardents who were experts in all manner of specialties, and per tradition, any man or woman could come to them and be apprenticed in a new skill or trade. The swordmasters, however, were his pride. Five of the six men rose and bowed to him. Dalinar turned to survey the room again. The smell of sweat, the clang of weapons. They were the signs of preparation. The world might be in chaos, but Alethkar prepared.
"Not Alethkar," he thought. "Eurythriu. My kingdom."
Storms, it was going to be difficult to accustom himself to that. He would always be Alethi, but once Elokar's proclamation came out, Alethkar would no longer be his. He still hadn't figured out how to present that fact to his armies. He wanted to give Navani and her scribes time to work out the exact legalities.
"You've done well here," Dalinar said to Kelerand, one of the swordmasters. "Ask Ivis if she'd look at expanding the training quarters into adjacent chambers. I want you to keep the troops busy. I'm worried about them getting restless and starting more fights."
"It will be done, Brightlord," Kelerand said, bowing.
"I'd like a spar myself," Dalinar said.
"I shall find someone suitable, Brightlord."
"What about you, Kelerand?" Dalinar said.
The Swordmaster bested Dalinar 2 out of 3 times, and though Dalinar had given up delusions of someday becoming the better swordsman, he was a soldier, not a duelist. He liked the challenge. "I will," Kelerand said stiffly, "of course, do as my High Prince commands, though if given a choice, I shall pass. With all due respect, I don't feel that I would make a suitable match for you today." Dalinar glanced toward the other standing swordmasters, who lowered their eyes. Swordmaster Ardens weren't generally like their more religious counterparts. They could be formal at times, but you could laugh with them. Usually. They were still Ardens, though.
"Very well," Dalinar said. "Find me someone to fight."
Though he'd intended it only as a dismissal of Kelerand, the other 4 joined him, leaving Dalinar. He sighed, leaning back against the wall, and glanced to the side. One man still lounged on his cushion. He wore a scruffy beard and clothing that seemed an afterthought. Not dirty, but ragged, belted with rope.
"Not offended by my presence, Zael?" Dalinar asked. "I'm offended by everyone's presence. You're no more revolting than the rest, Mr. High Prince."
Dalinar settled down on a stool to wait.
"You didn't expect this?" Zael said, sounding amused. "No, I thought, well, they're fighting Ardents, swordsmen, soldiers at heart." "You're dangerously close to threatening them with a decision, Brightlord. Choose between God and their High Prince. The fact that they like you doesn't make the decision easier, but more difficult." "Their discomfort will pass," Dalinar said. "My marriage, though it seems dramatic now, will eventually be a mere trivial note in history."
"Perhaps."
"You disagree?"
"Every moment in our lives seems trivial," Zael said. "Most are forgotten, while some, equally humble, become the points upon which history pivots. Like white on black."
"White on black?" Dalinar asked.
"Figure of speech."
"I don't really care what you did, High Prince. Light-eyed self-indulgence or serious sacrilege, either way it doesn't affect me. But there are those who are asking how far you're going to end up straying."
Dalinar grunted. Honestly, had he expected Zael, of all people, to be helpful? He stood up and began to pace, annoyed at his own nervous energy. Before the Ardens could return with someone for him to duel, he stalked back into the middle of the room, looking for soldiers he recognized. Men who wouldn't feel inhibited sparring with a High Prince. He eventually located one of General Kahl's sons. Not the Shardbearer, Captain Hallam Kahl, but the next oldest son, a beefy man with a head that had always seemed a little too small for his body. He was stretching after some wrestling matches.
"Auriton," Dalinar said. "You ever sparred with a High Prince?"
The younger man turned, then immediately snapped to attention.
"Sir?"
"No need for formality. I'm just looking for a match."
"I'm not equipped for a proper duel, Brightlord," he said. "Give me some time."
"No need," Dalinar said. "I'm fine for a wrestling match. It's been too long."
Some men would rather not spar with a man as important as Dalinar for fear of hurting him. Kahl had trained his sons better than that. The young man grinned, displaying a prominent gap in his teeth.
"Fine with me, Brightlord. But I'll have you know, I've not lost a match in months."
"Good," Dalinar said. "I need a challenge."
The swordmasters finally returned as Dalinar, stripped to the waist, was pulling on a pair of sparring leggings over his undershorts. The tight leggings came down only to his knees. He nodded to the swordmasters, ignoring the gentlemanly light eyes they'd sought out for him to spar, and stepped into the wrestling ring with Aratan Kal. His guards gave the swordmasters a kind of apologetic shrug, then Ryle counted off a start to the wrestling match. Dalinar immediately lunged forward and slammed into Kal, grabbing him under the arms, struggling to hold his feet back and force his opponent off balance. The wrestling match would eventually go to the ground, but you wanted to be the one who controlled when and how that happened. There was no grabbing the leggings in a traditional Veja match, and of course no grabbing hair, so Dalinar twisted, trying to get his opponent into a sturdy hold while preventing the man from shoving Dalinar over. Dalinar scrambled, his muscles taut, his fingers slipping on his opponent's skin. For those frantic moments, he could focus only on the match. His strength against that of his opponent. Sliding his feet, twisting his weight, straining for purchase. There was a purity to the contest, a simplicity that he hadn't experienced in what seemed like ages. Aratan pulled Dalinar tight, then managed to twist, tripping Dalinar over his hip. They went to the mat, and Dalinar grunted, raising his arm to his neck to prevent a chokehold, turning his head. Old training prompted him to twist and writhe before the opponent could get a good grip on him. Too slow. It had been years since he'd done this regularly. The other man moved with Dalinar's twist, foregoing the attempt at a chokehold, instead getting Dalinar under the arms from behind and pressing him down, face against the mat, his weight on top of Dalinar. Dalinar growled, and by instinct reached out for that extra reserve he'd always had. The pulse of the fight, the edge, the thrill. Soldiers spoke of it in the quiet of the night over campfires. That battle rage unique to the Alethi. Some called it the power of their ancestors, others the true mindset of the soldier. It had driven the Sunmaker to glory. It was the open secret of Alethi success. No, Dalinar stopped himself from reaching for it, but he needn't have worried. He couldn't remember feeling the thrill in months, and the longer he'd been apart from it, the more he'd begun to recognize that there was something profoundly wrong about the thrill. So he gritted his teeth and struggled, cleanly and fairly, with his opponent. And got pinned. Aratan was younger, more practiced at this style of fight. Dalinar didn't make it easy, but he was on the bottom, lacked leverage, and simply wasn't as young as he'd once been. Aratan twisted him over, and before too long Dalinar found himself pressed to the mat, shoulders down, completely immobilized. Dalinar knew he was beaten, but couldn't bring himself to tap out. Instead, he strained against the hold, teeth gritted, and sweat pouring down the sides of his face. He became aware of something. Not the thrill, but Stormlight in the pocket of his uniform trousers, lying beside the ring. Aratan grunted, arms like steel. Dalinar smelled his own sweat, the rough cloth of the mat. His muscles protested the treatment. He knew he could seize the Stormlight power, but his sense of fairness protested at the mere thought. Instead, he arched his back, holding his breath and heaving with everything he had, then twisted, trying to get back on his face for the leverage to escape. His opponent shifted, then groaned, and Dalinar felt the man's grip slipping slowly.
"Oh, for storm's sake," a feminine voice said. "Dalinar?"
Dalinar's opponent let go immediately, backing away. Dalinar twisted, puffing from exertion, to find Navani standing outside the ring with arms folded. He grinned at her, then stood up and accepted a light Takama overshirt and towel from an aide. As Aratan Kal retreated, Dalinar raised a fist to him and bowed his head, a sign that Dalinar considered Aratan the victor.
"Well played, son. An honor, sir."
Dalinar threw on the Takama, turning to Navani and wiping his brow with the towel.
"Come to watch me spar?"
"Yes. What every wife loves," Navani said. "Seeing that in his spare time her husband likes to roll around on the floor with half-naked, sweaty men."
She glanced at Aratan. Shouldn't you be sparring with men closer to your own age?
On the battlefield, Dalinar said, I don't have the luxury of choosing the age of my opponent. Best to fight at a disadvantage here to prepare.
He hesitated, then said more softly, I think I almost had him anyway.
Your definition of almost is particularly ambitious, Jem Hart.
Dalinar accepted a waterskin from an aide. Though Navani and her aides weren't the only women in the room, the others were ardents. Navani, in her bright yellow gown, still stood out like a flower on a barren stone field. As Dalinar scanned the chamber, he found that many of the ardents, not just the swordmasters, failed to meet his gaze. And there was Kadash, his former comrade in arms, speaking with the swordmasters. Nearby, Aratin was receiving congratulations from his friends. Pinning the blackthorn was considered quite the accomplishment. The young man accepted their praise with a grin, but he held his shoulder and winced when someone